take a knee and say, is it our father, they say? Is it
one of the hits?
Yeah. I've never understood why this isn't match fixing. If that's what's going on, then why is it not match fixing?
OTB AM, live weekday mornings from 7:30 on the OTB Sports app.
OTB AM. With Gillette, put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
Good morning, welcome to Friday's OTB AM. We've just been talking about, Owen's been watching. Name that, who is that European leader?
I can't believe people haven't been watching this. If nobody was watching Macron. Emmanuel Macron bash a penalty past another celebrity goalkeeper, then I don't know what you were doing with your Thursday afternoon.
He looks like a footballer. Like, looking at him there, I think, oof, God, that's good, really good warm-up technique.
Like, I mean, he's certainly got those high knees nailed.
It's not quite sort of Maradona, but it's pretty good.
It was a terrible penalty, by the way.
Was it a penalty shootout, or they won?
No, they won a penalty, and then Macron, I don't think, even gets fouled. He comes like roaring up the pitch. I didn't see the full game, by the way. I'm not even sure. Was this the same game that Arsene Wenger was playing in the other day? Wenger was playing alongside Marcel Desailly at centre back for a game. Maybe they just have a lot of charity football matches this week in France, or maybe it was the same game. But anyway, the only clip that I saw was of Macron taking the penalty, and it was a terrible penalty, but the keeper also happened to be terrible, and it kind of went through his flailing legs. And Macron is, you know, one from one in terms of his football played this week.
I've just looked up, and having recently pulled out of the duathlon that we were to do last weekend, I've just looked up Emmanuel Macron's age just to see what sort of, you know, what how he's getting on. 43, younger than I am, and fit on it on.
I think that's the first time you've sort of nailed down your specific age for years of OTB AM.
That is absolutely inaccurate. I'm proudly 44 on.
Nice.
What's that?
It's all coming out this
morning. Young for it. No, true. Look at
I often get that, actually. People say that Adrian Barry does look quite young for his age. They often comment on your skin as a good factor for age. So whatever you're doing, keep it up.
Just a lot of clean living. I'm thinking about starting a clean living podcast, Owen, as you can tell.
The wine and cheese on a Saturday for the URC.
I've been considering coming up with like a sort of a regime. I went for a swim yesterday, which was the first bit of exercise that I've done outside of the training that I did for the duathlon, which was minimal, but ended up injuring me enough to have to withdraw from the thing last weekend. But I went for a swim yesterday and felt great about it. I need to come up with... I've decided that I'm going to do that tomorrow, whether it's like a swim or a run or a bit of yoga or whatever you're having yourself. I'll do that tomorrow. Just actually doesn't work. So I think I'm going to come up with like a personal fitness. No, not fitness. What's the other word? Like well-being. A personal well-being program. So if anybody,
bring us along on your journey
and sort of make any suggestions. The only stuff I've got really that I'd like to do are swimming. So what I've decided on is I'm going to do the plan for me now, right? Like, there's no point in doing it for me in 6 months' time when I get really fit and I'm ready to run a marathon. So the only things I really have in mind that I want to do at the minute are stretching, yoga, swimming. I'd like to do a run. I'm not sure my body is up for it. And that's probably about it. Cycling, sort of really give or take cycling. It's find it quite boring, actually.
Right. So, I mean, these are all the boxes you need to tick if you want to join the Adrian Barry Fit by Christmas plan. Is that it? Like, I mean, you've got two months to get to tone those abs for Christmas week.
Toning the abs is so far away from where I'm at the minute. But anyway, look, that's the fitness update. All's well with you?
All is well. Can't complain.
Good man. Right, there's some news from last night that we want to get into in just a minute. But at 7:34 on this Friday morning, here's what's coming up on OTB AM for you today. Some news from Croke Park last night, bringing that your way in just a couple of moments' time. We're going to talk to Gareth Roberts from the Anfield Wrap, founder of the Anfield Wrap, about all things Liverpool just after 8 o'clock this morning. Pretty interesting times at Anfield. WSL and all the very latest from there, including the 4-0 win for Arsenal last night, the Champions League. Brilliant result. Kenny McCabe flying it. So many Irish players flying it at the minute. We'll get the thoughts of Flo Lloyd-Hughes, football writer, for you there, 20 past 8. The GEA Special Congress, we'll have more of that at 8:30 this morning. Sports news with JD at 9:15. We're going to talk to Alan Quinlan about lots to talk to Quinny about his new documentary series on Virgin Media. We'll get his inside opinion on that. 6 years since the passing of Anthony Foley as well, almost to the day. So we will, 5 years that we will get Quinny's reflections on the life of the great man, and we look ahead as well to some of the games upcoming over the weekend. And at about 9:15 then, the big dogs are out on for the crappy quiz. you've managed to get them all out of bed for a live crappy quiz.
Yeah, it's rare. It's rare that you have such a beautiful moment where yourself, Nathan and Ger are all available on a Friday morning.
It's a beautiful moment. You're listening to too much Arsene Wenger. But yeah, that's what's coming up. Cara Kane then was talking to Nathan on the show last night. We're bringing that your way before 10 a.m. this morning. Do keep your comments coming into us over the course of the day. We'd love to hear from you. You're watching OTB AM, brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. So the news we mentioned for you at the very top there, coming from Croke Park last night, in case you haven't been following this, and it was late last night when it started to come through, but the GA Director of Finance stood up last night to address the treasurers of the various county boards, and he basically put a death knell in the in Proposal B that we've been discussing over the last little while. And just to give you the details from that, saying last night, Croke Park saying that Conor O'Donoghue's estimates of 18,000 plus, which he told us were based in terms of attendances, that he said were based on the 2018-19 games, Croke Park saying that those numbers are wrong, that they'd be more in the region of 8,000 to 9,000, so about half of that. Which is a huge differential when you think about it. Now, Conor Donoghue did say that there was loads of room for manoeuvre within his estimates, that if they came in significantly lower, that would still make money, at least as much as it had been making. Croke Park also saying that Conor Donoghue didn't take into account the juvenile and other concessions. Croke Park saying that they see gates going up in Proposal B by 20%. So that attendances will be up, I should say, rather than gates, will be up by 20%, but that won't increase revenue. So that was the essence of what the Director of Finance was saying last night when he addressed the treasurers of the various county boards. It's obviously a really interesting development, given that we're 8 days out from the Special Congress, which will take place to vote on whether it's Proposal A, which there's really no sort of right thinking, it doesn't seem, advocate for at the minute. Proposal B, which there's a big weight behind, the GPA have come out in full force. We've had several speakers on, weighty names in the GA have been on over the last few weeks, who've really endorsed Proposal B, and then obviously status quo is the last one, which it seems, and last night's utterances in relation to the finances would endorse the idea that that's what Croke Park want to go with, at least for now. And look, it does beg some questions on from the address last night. The GA obviously had set up the special task force, and you would have to ask the question as to why it's taken so long for them to come to a position where we can get some insight into the finances. I think a lot of this had come from Brian McAvoy's, the Ulster Secretary, who was on with you about 10 days ago. A lot of this had come from there, in that he was saying he hadn't seen any of the finances around it. Then Conor O'Donoghue, who was part of that task force, came out and explained in great detail as to where their estimates had come from around that. So you do wonder then, obviously that's potentially what's prompted the GAA to come out now and give their side of it, and to say that actually those really aren't the finances, and that the GAA wouldn't be any better off by going with Proposal B. So, but you do wonder, you ask the question as to whether, why it's taken so long. You absolutely have to assume that the top brass at Croke Park, they obviously have the best of the games in mind, you know, very good GA people. You do wonder though why it's taken until 8 days out from the Special Congress to get full sight of, and even at that it's not really full sight of the numbers, because I watched back the Conor O'Donoghue piece from yourselves during the week on, where he was talking about the unexplored nature of the media rights. Like, I wonder why they're unexplored. Like, why are we leaving to chance this huge factor in whether Proposal B could be a success or not?
Yeah, it's certainly a lot of guesswork when it comes to what we're talking about here, and that does remove the possibility of us coming to some sort of conclusion in this debate that's emerged about whether or not this thing would be financially worthwhile. I think what last night, in terms of what Jeremy Ryan is saying, it would suggest, if you're taking everything that he says and running with it, it would suggest that Proposal B will be of no financial difference to the status quo. So the financial factor is negligible. So he has not come out and said this is going to be a financial catastrophe for the GAA. He has come out and said, no, there will not be the 10 million euro increase across provinces and across Central Council as a result of Proposal B. So I think that distinction is important to make, first of all. So it almost removes the financial aspect. He is saying that it'll essentially be, you'll break even, I mean, yeah. from this new thing. So then it becomes a football decision, maybe, if you take what he has said and run with it. Now, maybe that's a little bit of a weak argument, so maybe you need to get into what he's actually saying.
Look at it, that is, and it's worth just lingering on for a second, because it is worth... it's worth discussion. Like, it's an interesting point in that he's not saying this is suddenly going to result in, you know, a 10 million windfall for the GAA. I think everybody's being, you know, Conor Dunne was certainly, it seemed to me, holding himself in the bridle of estimates, right? Like, I think he used the word conservative quite a bit. It was quite clear from that piece that his feeling was that actually it would do much more even than he was saying. But if you take the GPA bit of wanting fairness, development and change... And with Jermall Ryan saying that you know, the Plan B would hold the status quo, let's call it, in terms of the financial side of things, but it would obviously address the fairness, development and change element. So it still makes a pretty strong case, right, for even, you know, even taking into account what the statement last night, it still makes a pretty strong case for Proposal B.
It does, of course, but I think then what you need to drill down into as well is what's actually being put forward. Why is he saying that this will only lead to finances breaking even, or maybe just a slight reduction, or basically the negligible response on a financial level? And one of his key points from what he's saying is on O'Donoghue's figures being inflated. He says the use of average attendance of Super 8 games in 2018 and 19. He was criticised, and I'm quoting from John Fogarty's piece in The Examiner, by the way, when average league attendances in Division 1 of 8,000 to 9,000 were considered as a more realistic metric in modelling the All-Ireland Senior Football Championship League in summer. His numbers not reflecting juvenile and other concessions were also highlighted. So there's two points there. The first thing is the difference between the Super 8s and Division 1. So Conor O'Donoghue did use Super 8s figures to predict how many people would show up on average to Division 1 of the league as championship format, rather than using the National League. And I think that's absolutely fair enough. Like, I absolutely do. Like, there is definitely a case to be made that the Super 8s are a greater indicator of what a league in the summertime will provide attendance-wise than the National League will, for a whole host of obvious reasons. One of the like very obvious ones is that a lot of counties actually use smaller grounds, and they'll have bigger grounds available to them in the summer when they feel that they can actually get 20, 30,000 people in there. Like, I even just parsing through some of the figures last night, this is a completely incomplete list, because A, it's hard to find attendance figures for a lot of things, and B, it was late and I wanted to go to bed before compiling this last night. But like, you look at the last couple of meetings between Kerry and Mayo, for example, in both competitions. National League in Castlebar last year drew a crowd of 8,000 people. The last time they met in the Super 8s, which was in Killarney the previous year, drew a crowd of over 31,000 people. So which is more likely? Which of those figures do you think is going to be closer to accurate if Kerry and Mayo play each other in either Castlebar or Killarney in this National Summer League? I suspect it'll be way higher than the 8,000, and it will be closer to the 30,000, especially on Kerry's home fixture. When you look at Tyrone versus Dublin, this is maybe more accurate, because both of their last games in both competitions were in the same venue. They were both played at Healy Park. The National League game in 2020 drew a crowd of 3,850. They met the previous summer in the Super 8s, which was a dead rubber, by the way. 15,315 people showed up to the same venue. So where are we getting the notion that figures will be closer to the 3,000 than the 15,000, because this will be in summertime. This will be far closer to the Super 8s model than it will be the National League model. And let's not forget that the Super 8s has been slammed by a hell of a lot of people as a failed mission, as something that people weren't interested in, that the crowds maybe were a little bit underwhelming. Like, that plays into the idea that O'Donoghue has had modest figures and utilised modest figures and made a modest prediction of where things will go. That if you're going to say the Super 8s wasn't great and people didn't really have any interest in that, well, then you have to accept that O'Donoghue can go along and use those figures, because they are modest at best, because this will be championship. This will be something that everybody goes into and has a real crack of getting out of their group. So I don't know. I would definitely be of the opinion that leaning towards the Super 8s figures was totally fair. Now, in fairness, the other point that is made here is with regards to juvenile and other concessions. As far as I'm aware, Conor O'Donoghue came up with his calculations from scratch on both fronts. So he would have said, right, it's €20 for a ticket in the summertime, and whatever, applied the ticket prices to the league as well. But he is also forgetting about juvenile and other concessions when it comes to his calculations for the National League and to the winter games, as well as to the summertime. So, yes, of course, there will be a greater degree of missing out on the juvenile or concessions there for the summertime, but he's also done it for the wintertime as well. As far as I'm aware, his maths were pretty consistent along both lines. So he hasn't forgotten the juvenile and concessions just for this new championship. If you're saying that, I think he would have done so for the earlier part of the league as well. It's a small point, but it's an important one.
Well,
because
he did totally address it in the piece that he did with G about allowing for concessions. That's definitely, I mean, I'm assuming that the GA have seen and have gone through, I'm absolutely certain they would have gone through his full details outside of just the stuff that he said to the media. I'm sure they've gone through it with a fine-tooth comb, but he certainly did, when he was on with us, make a very big point of saying that he had addressed the concession side. You do wonder as well on, like, that the just in terms of one of the other questions about it, like that we're, so number one, we're 8 days out from the special Congress. Why are we only seeing the full insight into the finances behind it now? And also, like, the GEA set up the task force themselves. Surely a big lesson out of this is that once next time we're looking at the shift in proposals, could we sit down once the proposals are done, and particularly given that the task force was set up by the GEA initially, surely straight away after that you're sitting down to stress test the finances of it collectively. Before anybody leaves the room, they're saying, right, that's part one of this done. Now we need to go and look at the finances. We need to look at attendances. We need to look at number of games. We need to look at media fees. We need to look at sponsorship out of this. Like, those factors for me are just so big. I just don't, like, they're significant weights on the balance one way or another. And they come to some sort of conclusion after Conor Dunne, who was saying he was speaking to some big names out and about around the country who know about the commercial side or know about the media rights bit. Like, get your experts in, get people from media houses in, and stress that stuff. Next time there are a suite of proposals on the table, could we just do that bit? Because it's a big factor. Like, Jeremy Ryan's comments last night obviously carry massive weight. I'm sure they're, obviously the treasurers around the country will be taking that message back to their delegates, and there'll be plenty of them picking up the papers this morning, or tuned into us this morning to see that this is what's coming from Croke Park. It's it's a big enough piece, I think, to have left this late.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. Like, one of the other elements that's come up, and John Fogarty's obviously done a lot of work on this over the last 24 hours, is that we do have another important voice weighing in on the matter. Kieran Leddy of Munster Council has gone on the record to talk about all this. And it's actually kind of a double piece sort of approach to this in the Irish Examiner this morning. I might just start with his piece with Fogarty on the financial aspect of it. And, like, we should state here that it's great to see people like Kieran Leddy come out. He's the chief executive of Munster GEA. We had a similar situation with Brian McAvoy last week. And yes, you may disagree with Brian McAvoy, but he was one of a very small number of people who was willing to go on the record and say, this is why I think this isn't going to work. And that's great. That's what we want to see. So the same goes for Kieran Leddy this morning. And he's got a real issue with the financial possibilities of what happens with the Munster Championship. So that's his ballpark. And you've got to hear him out on this. Like, he talks about the possibility of the Munster Championship turning into the McGrath Cup if you put it earlier in the year. And he says that it could just turn into something where the figures, the attendance figures, will actually start to resemble the McGrath Cup over a period of time. Like, he mentions that the average attendance between 2017 and 2019 at a McGrath Cup game was 650, and one of those games included a Kerry Cork game which had 1500 at it. I was at that Kerry Cork game. It was the Kerry under 21s that played Cork on that day. I think it's probably important to point that out. Nobody gives a damn about the McGrath Cup. Mm-hmm. I think what's been proposed here is a doomsday scenario. And you know what? Somebody in charge of a province like that maybe has to look at the doomsday scenario. But maybe it's a little bit OTT. Will only 1,500 people show up to a Kerry Cork game in the early part of the year if they know it's the Munster Championship? I don't suspect that's the way. I suspect it'd be much harder than...
Stress testing is what we're talking about, right? But, like, stress testing is based in some modicum of reality. Like, the numbers that you're talking about there for full-on inter-county games at whatever level, they're just, as you said, the McGrath Cup is an irrelevance, as are a lot of those pre-tournament games that are run off. I don't think they're really a basis for anything.
It's worth pointing out as well, just what he's saying about the finances. He talks about the 20 euro charge that Conor O'Donoghue would have used in his, like, Phil O'Donoghue's name is being mentioned a lot here. He's just the guy who's had the wherewithal to actually put some figures on paper, because there was a complete vacuum of that. So, like, I mean, maybe he's getting unfairly an undue amount of spotlight on him, maybe, as a result of this. But I mean, it's his figures, and it seems that they're still very, very robust. So he says that he doesn't see it being feasible to charge 20 euro for a pre-season, or sorry, a provincial championship competition, because it's a standalone round robin competition. He says, we charge 20 euro for a seat at our provincial round robin hurling championship, but that is the championship and it's linked to the central council championship, whereas this isn't, which is a fair point. He says a McGrath Cup ticket is 5 euro, so we feel 10 euro would be a more correct pricing for such a competition, and then mentions the same thing again about kids and concessions not being brought into proceedings here as well, which again, the previous point, you suspect that he would have used the same process to either ignore or take into account concessions when it comes to the provincial championships as the All-Ireland championships in the summertime. In fairness, I can see why people like Kieran Leddy have this concern, and maybe more official figures would have actually changed that. It does seem that he's obviously got his finger on the pulse when it comes to the finances of Munster. There's absolutely no question about it in his position, so he absolutely knows what he's talking about. And it does come down to this fact, and it almost proves the suspicion that we had from the very start, that the thing that would decide this or break this was money and finance, and that is totally understandable, and that is the real sticking point that we're at now, as you say, 8 days out from Congress.
We could have done it all 2 years ago. All the details of these proposals are all available on the GEA website from 2019, as far as I'm aware. I just think that we could have got into this a lot sooner. Like, I also think if I am Conor O'Donoghue this morning, or if I'm Eddie Sullivan who chaired the group, I'm feeling pretty sore that they couldn't have collectively... They really collectively should have stress tested all this stuff and come out as one. If it's the task forces coming from within the GEA, surely they could have come out as one and said, here are the proposals from, there's the two sides to it. From the games point of view, we talked about the fairness and the change that the GPA had mentioned. So it addresses that, and here's the reasons for that. And then over on the other side, it's got to make financial sense, lads. So we've had a look at that, and here's what that is. Now, maybe they've all been sitting on those numbers for the last couple of years, and they have been sort of over and back about it behind the scenes. But I would have thought that part of the specific remit of something like a task force like that's been set up, that once proposals are set in train, that the finances are run, and we come out and talk to people about exactly how they look.
Just one other point from the Leddy pieces this morning. Just one quote here stuck out to me. He said, I wonder really what value will that be for Kerry, who are preparing for a Division 1 in the Championship. So he's talking about the provincial finals essentially running into the All-Ireland Championship. So what value will be in that provincial championship for Kerry, who are preparing for Division 1? And we would also be concerned as to whether broadcasters and so forth will have that much interest in the four provinces. Could we only see live Gaelic football on our screens from the end of April up to the middle of July? 2 points on that. First of all, as you've already said, that possibly could have been sorted out before now. Mm-hmm. The second one, that is an admission that the provinces are dead. That is an admission from the CEO of the Munster Council that their product isn't good enough to possibly attract broadcasters up until the end of April, which is why we are in this position in the first place. He has doubts that his competition will actually attract broadcasters. If people don't want to show your product, the product is probably broken, and these conversations are really, really important to be having then. And this idea then that maybe more debate should have been had before now, this should have been a topic of emergency before now, you suspect.
Is he not saying that in the context of the new competition? So he's saying the current provincial championship is absolutely perfect, but this thing in the new format, now that wouldn't attract.
Of course, but it's still the same teams.
It's the Brian McAvoy point about you're killing the provincial championship, is essentially.
Well, I think if you look at the Ulster Championship, if the Ulster Championship is on television early in the year, next year, are you going to watch it? Of course you're going to watch it.
Yeah.
Whereas I think this points to the weakness in the Munster Championship, and I would be surprised if the Leinster stakeholders and all this aren't thinking the same thing. I think, in fairness, Connacht is a little bit different. I mean, we would certainly watch a lot of Connacht football early in the year, but I think this points to the broken system that we have, and it's accentuated in Munster and in Leinster.
Yeah,
that's the specific point I mean here. That your provincial championship, if it was really absolutely essential and totally worth protecting, should be able to survive a shift to earlier in the calendar. But there are real concerns that that's not going to be the case. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong. It absolutely could be a reality where this thing totally fizzles out as a result of being moved to earlier in the year. We don't know the answer. But the person we've had on the record on this has been Niall Morgan, who says no. Not at all, but he's talking from an Ulster perspective, so and it's different to Munster. I accept that totally.
Even from a Leinster Football Championship point of view, and we'll move on now, but even from a Leinster Championship point of view, like the fact that it's been such a dead duck over the last couple of years, that in fact, I mean, you could make a really strong case that the Leinster Championship is about to just get a little bit more competitive. I mean, it is going to get more competitive. It seems like it couldn't be any less competitive, of course, as it's been over the last 10 years, but you would feel that, and the evidence of last year, that the gap between Dublin and the rest are getting a bit closer, and so it might actually be worth looking at.
This is the thing.
But again, like when we're talking about stress test, that's the thing that exists over here on the this is a possibility bit that nobody is even really talking about.
I think when we're talking about this, Adrian, we have to be straight up here. There is a fear in every one of us that this is the opportunity. If there was some guarantee that Proposal B doesn't get through and the GEA will either look at Proposal B and try their best to make the amendments that will go some way to satisfying the real concerns that people like Kieran Leddy have and bring it back to Congress next year, I'm not sure there would be such even vociferous support for Proposal B, because there is this sense that when you get an opportunity at GEA Congress, you have to take it with both hands, even if it's only 80-85% of what the championship structure could be. Getting something that's 80-85% of what a championship structure could be is an absolute home run from my perspective when it comes to the championship structure. But maybe we should have more hope. Maybe this is the thing that sparks real conversation on a pretty fast-tracked basis to get something like this over the line over the next couple of years, because there is going to be a pretty heavy stick to beat a lot of people with come next summer, when we do see hockeyings in the Munster Championship, in the Connacht Championship, in the Leinster Championship, and even in the Ulster Championship, let's face it. And everybody will be like, oh, if only we voted in one of those proposals last winter. It'll be such an easy thing to criticise the powers that be with. So you'd like to hope that maybe this is the first step towards something, if this doesn't get through on Saturday week, and you'd have to say it's looking increasingly unlikely that it will get through Proposal B.
Yeah, and I would say as well that coming from a county that, like, you get very fatigued by the discussion about the championship through the lens of Dublin and Kerry and Tyrone and Donegal and Mayo. Like, somebody spare a thought for the rest of us those conversations are just not real. And the reason that you're talking about grasping the nettle now for me is so important. And somebody is on YouTube this morning asking, why are the media pushing Proposal B so much? Ask Michael on YouTube. Like,
we don't get these opportunities very often, is the answer to that.
For me, it's not about the top 6, 7, 8 teams. It's about the rest of us who really have fleeting interest in the, like, it's you know, adapt another team and go and support somebody else. It's a lot of work been done over the last 20 years, obviously, with the backdoor side of things, that at least means it's not just one and done. But bloody hell, spare a thought for the rest of us. And for me, the reason that I'd be passionate about making sure that a proposal like this is at the very least discussed openly and honestly, and that everything is on the table about the, you know, to make an informed and as informed decision as possibly can, is that, like, that suddenly there's an opportunity for the likes of Westmeath to get a whole pile of meaningful games that don't just depend on, you know, having to beat Dublin every year and then, you know, the look at the draw after that. Because it's been the Super 8s, it's the best thing about the Super 8s, this proposal for me, in that you get that journey around the country, you get the opportunity to take on teams at a similar level, but up to now, that's all been look at the draw stuff, whereas this is by design.
Can I ask you something as a Mead supporter? And Jeremy made this point the other day that yes, the television
to their own, but go on, yeah.
As what?
I'm definitely not a Mead supporter, but go on anyway.
What? Oh, sorry, Westmead cheating. Oh my God, I apologise. Whoa, God.
Cut that. We'll cut that. Just podcast. Slur.
The West is silent. Like Ger was making the point the other day that like the television figures are important. There's no getting away from that. Exposure in the media is important. But what's also important is people showing up and coming to these games. As we've seen over the course of the last 12 hours, it could well be the deciding factor in a lot of people's minds here is people showing up. So how much more likely are you to go watch Westmeath in a league as championship game in the summer than a National League game in the winter, for example, or a Leinster Championship game?
Look, the short answer to that is very likely. The fact that there are more games, the fact that you'll be taken on, particularly in a Westmeath context, and every sort of county and every setup is different. There's a load of counties that neighbour around Westmeath, all of whom are at roughly the same kind of level. So there's that added little bit of rivalry. You're going to end up in the same pot as a load of those teams. But like, look, it's the opportunity to have the likes of me. Like, I'll go to, you know, I'm not making, if Westmeath get drawn against Kerry in the championship, as you know, the back door somehow in some sort of la la land, it's a long trip for me to be making to know that Westmeath are going to get beaten at the gap by 20 points. I will and have gone to Croke Park on several occasions to watch them getting beaten out the gap again by Dublin. But I'd far rather, I was at a club championship game in Hogan Park in Motown about 2 weeks ago with a couple of hundred people watching Athlone getting beaten out the gap by St. Lomans. So this is something I'm well used to. But the point being that I'm more than happy to get down there. It was a crunch championship match where one team is going to get put back into the B championship and the other team was going to get was into the quarterfinals of the county championship. So it's the likes of me really who, you know, will try and get to six or seven or eight games a year and pay into them that they really should be trying to tap into. And that's another reason why I would say that I know that Michael has some sort of conspiracy theory in mind here when he's wondering about the media pushing it, but personally speaking, that would be a big factor in my backing for it.
The other thing here, and this kind of plays into the coverage, is I think the last couple of weeks have really shown what 130 odd years can do to how tunnel visioned people can get. And like, that's not in any way saying that it's not a negative comment on anybody, like that just happens when you have the idea of tradition. It becomes very, very ingrained, and it started to drip feed down into media coverage of the championship. So that I've seen some of this and say talk about Division 2, 3 and 4 spoken about it through the prism of the Sunday game. And I think Cathal O'Kane in his piece the other day had said that this new reality isn't going to change the fact that you will get 30 seconds of a Division 4 game on the Sunday game.
Yeah, and don't talk to me.
But the point is that why are we viewing this through the prism of what's already existed?
Yeah.
Why is the highlights show on a Sunday night still the thing that is the greatest vehicle towards great coverage? Like, there's no Sunday night highlight show or Monday night show for the NFL when it's got 32 teams with 32 fan bases who all have an important game pretty much every week until the dead rubber start to come along and at the end of the regular season. It's because there are too many games, and it's because that is just not fit for purpose. You could argue that Match of the Day probably is barely fit for purpose, but it's soccer rather than Gaelic football.
But like that point that you're making there, like, there's nothing more frustrating coming from a county like where I come from than the end of week wrap of what's going on. Like, my exposure to my own team, unless I'm getting out to games, which, as I said, can be hard, is
but the highlight show format is not going to be good enough to satisfy people through this new proposal if proposal B gets through. So to use that as some sort of stick to beat it with, I don't understand that, and I think everything needs to change. I think there needs to be a total shift in how people view how the games are covered and judging the value of your county based on how many minutes you're getting on the highlight show on a Sunday night. I just don't think it is fair on anybody, and I don't think that's a fair argument whatsoever. Things need to change completely, and part of that is also factoring in how determined people are to actually show up to these games, as well as how many minutes you're getting on a Sunday night.
Shehan Lash is a Sunday game. That's
not at all. Not at all. Like, I think it's absolutely hamstrung sometimes with what I can do. So it's more the reality of the volume of games that this would pose.
4 minutes past eight. We've loads of comments coming into this. We will be back to it a bit later in the show. So do keep your comments coming in, whether it's pro or against or whatever it might be. Do lash them into us, and we'll bring them to our audience between now and 10 a.m. this morning. We have packed show still to come. We're going to talk Liverpool in the Garth Roberts next. OTB.
AM.
8:05, OTB AM. Very good morning to you, wherever it is you are. We're going to talk Liverpool now. Founder of the Anfield Rap, Gareth Roberts. Good morning, Gareth.
Good morning.
And thanks a million for joining us. How are you getting on?
Yeah, not bad. Yourselves?
Good, good. I'm interested, first of all, before we get into the Liverpool stuff, it's the topic of the week. What are your thoughts on what's going on up the road with Newcastle?
Yeah, we discussed this on the Anfield Rap podcast this week, and one of the things that sort of I've found a little bit disturbing, distressing, is just sort of how people are reacting towards fellow football fans, really. I mean, look, you know, awareness of what's going on in Saudi Arabia and has gone on in Saudi Arabia will now no doubt go up, and people will be looking into it, and I'm looking into it myself a lot more now, because look, it's on the table and it's in front of us, and there is a club in our league now owned by the Saudi Arabia state, despite what they say and what the Premier League say. I mean, anyone can see that this public fund is actually the state. It is actually the Saudi government. And once you start looking into their actions, obviously they are incredibly grim around human rights, around LGBT rights, or lack of, around the repression of women, around war crimes in Yemen, all of the rest of it. And to allow someone like that through the door and to own a football club in England would seemingly, you know, they just wave through. And the only sort of thing that seemed to be stopping them at one point was piracy of Premier League coverage. I mean, it's a little bit of a joke. And what I was saying was I found depressing, distressing, etc. is not only that, but the way football fans are turning on each other and saying, OK, well, how dare Newcastle fans be happy that Mike Ashley is gone? How dare they be happy about that the club might now show some ambition? And the reason I'm saying this is not everyone out there is an expert in foreign affairs, me included. I mean, I got a lot of stick for saying, you know, why are people turning on fans? Because they said, well, do you not know what's going on in Saudi? And I said, well, I know there's human rights issues. And I literally had a thread of tweets coming after me from one particular man saying, well, what about Yemen? What about Yemen? So I've looked into Yemen now, and what's gone on in Yemen's grim, but I didn't know before. Mm. And I can't talk about something I didn't know. So my thing here is that the anger should be directed at the Premier League, because the Premier League have allowed this through. And yet again, we're talking about the fit and proper test for owners that they've got, or lack of. But even when you dig into that, you know, there is a real sat there that would allow them to have stopped this deal, and they've waved it through nevertheless. And obviously, the way that they're doing it is to say in this public board is different to the state, when it's not. There is a rule there that says in the reasonable opinion of the board, he, she, potential owner, is engaged in conduct outside of the UK that would constitute an offence if such conduct had taken place in the UK, whether or not such conduct resulted in a conviction, then they can decide not to approve the deal. So when people are saying about what's gone on in Saudi and what continues to go on there, and whether these people should be allowed anywhere near a football club, that should be a conversation aimed at the Premier League, not aimed at Newcastle fans. Because I just think, to say to a fan, a football fan who supported their club all their lives, okay, then walk away now, that isn't fair. And that, you know, there will be people that are growing up where football is their lives, football is their only way out, football is the bright part of a grim week, and they'll be living, you know, there are people who save up all week to go to football matches, and there will be people who are not studying what is going on in Saudi Arabia. So all they will see is the headlines, they will see the money, they will see Mike Ashley gone, and they will think this is better times ahead for my club. And I don't think that should be held against football fans. As I say, the conversation should be about this test, the Premier League, and tightening that test up and doing something about letting people like this into England to run football clubs.
Could we just tease that point out? Because I do agree that it's very easy for fans of other clubs, and sometimes it just comes down to basic rivalry that they, you know, it's easy to have a pop. So I do totally take that point. But at the same time, the manifestation of the sports washing bit is the Newcastle fans cheering and parading about and like doing the things that you would do. And look, at part of it is to do with Mike Ashley is gone, so I think we have to accept that and sort of compartmentalise that almost in the conversation. But the other bit is the bit that, you know, you have the Fenway Sports Group, or you have some other legitimate business interest getting involved in the club. Like, that very public manifestation of, we suddenly get lots of money and the club is owned by somebody else and there's a future ahead, versus where the money is coming from. I do certainly have a sympathy for the discussion about the fans' celebration in this instance being that very public face of sports washing.
Yeah, I mean, even that term, I mean, you know what it means, I know what it means, and it is depressed, and once you start digging into it and seeing what's being done, because all of the stuff that I mentioned that Saudi Arabia have been doing and the way they run their country, you know, this is a cynical attempt to make people talk about something else in relation to Saudi Arabia. So talk about a successful football team, talk about, you know, bankroll and signings and managers and everything else. And look, you know, for me to go particularly deep on this, I found it another little chunk of another depressing factor about modern football, if you like. I mean, maybe it's the age I'm at, maybe it's some of the things I'm living through myself currently, but you know, a little bit of me is dying all the time around football, and this is another part of it dying. You know, Liverpool themselves, you know, once upon a time, you know, Shinawatra was linked with a move for Liverpool. We had the Dubai group linked with Liverpool. Obviously, there's the owners of Manchester City. There's the owners of Paris Saint-Germain. There's the fact that there's a World Cup in Qatar. And we just go on and on and on. And it just sort of, it feels to me that an awful lot of the time these days is spent not actually talking about football. And, you know, my lad is 13 and he's into football, but not the way I was when I was 13. So when I was 13, I was going the match on the regular. I would be out in the streets playing football. My son came to me and said, "Oh, Newcastle, the richest club in the world. Newcastle have got all this money." And I said, "Is that what your mates talk about with you? Like, you're all talking about the money, are you?" And he said, "Yeah, yeah." And I just thought, well, I used to talk about something I seen John Barnes do on the pitch. I used to talk about goals and moments in football matches. And I just feel like sometimes the way football is, the way football news is, the fact that there's something like this to talk about seemingly week after week at times, you know, the actual football gets lost. And, you know, I'm really looking forward to sort of Saturday 12:30, Liverpool playing Watford, and being able to watch men run around with a ball on a bit of green grass and it matter for a moment, because it constantly feels like there are these huge issues that shouldn't be anything to do with football, really, but become about football because, as I say, people like these are allowed through the gate in this country and are allowed to manage a football team.
With the obvious exception of technology and FIFA, for example, Gareth, is there anything else that you've seen as a reason for that, as a reason why the behaviours of young football fans have changed? Or is it all to do with FIFA and the sort of fetishization of money and how many players you can buy for your ultimate team, etc. that has created this sort of relationship that your boy would have with football now, for example?
Yeah, FIFA undoubtedly plays a part of it, and you know, he plays FIFA and he plays that with his friends, plays that with me. But I mean, it's so big, that conversation. You know, it's access to tickets, it's the way football is all over the television seemingly 24/7 these days. There's a saturation of it in terms of football in media, basically. So I think, you know, when I was growing up, yes, there was football on the television, but nowhere near compared to what we get now. Like, you could feasibly sit down every day of the week pretty much now, couldn't you, and watch a football match. Then, you know, you got Match of the Day. You're talking about that on a different piece there. You got Match of the Day. You got the big match, I think, on ITV. Obviously, going back a long way, I'm an old man. I'm 45 now. But I just think with there being so much football on the television, there's maybe not as much incentive to actually go to a match. There's maybe not as much incentive to fall in love with that aspect of the game. And see, that's certainly what's happened with my son. Like, he doesn't have the concentration to watch a whole football match. He'll watch bits of a match. He appreciates skill. He'll watch sort of compilations of players and things like that. He loves all that aspect of it. He loves superstars, but he doesn't love the team aspect. He doesn't love the go in the game, everything that comes around the game, the culture of the game, all of the things that I love. He's not really been bitten by that as yet, and maybe that will change. But I always remember there's a local football team to where, not far from where I grew up, called Prescott Gables, a non-league side. And I remember they did a bit of a campaign of trying to encourage people to just come through the gate and watch some football in person. and they did a thing. I don't think they were alone in doing this. I think they probably got it from somewhere else. But they did a campaign that said, don't let your children grow up thinking football's a television programme. And I thought that was a good point because, you know, even non-league as well, you know, actually going to a game, seeing the tackles first and seeing the, you know, the players having a moan at the referee, hearing what other people are saying around you, the sights, the smells, all of those things are totally different to just sitting down on the couch and watching football on TV. It's a different experience, but it feels to me that maybe for some generation, for some people growing up, that is becoming a bit of an issue. I mean, I've noticed as well locally recently that some of the non-league sides around Liverpool as well are getting really good attendances lately, like much, much better than, you know, some years back. And again, I wonder why that is. Like, is this Premier League roller coaster becoming, you know, a bit too much for some people? Are they like, well, I'd rather go and watch some real football in quotation marks? Mm-hmm. And I do wonder why those numbers are going up. It's a good thing. I've always supported non-league football myself. But I just wonder, you know, why significantly are those numbers going up for certain clubs? I mean, Marine, for instance, had a big FA Cup run and obviously played Tottenham Hotspur last season. So that will have put them on people's radars. But they're getting, you know, 1,000+ virtually every game. And they're playing Wrexham this weekend in the FA Cup. And so they'll get another bumper crowd there. And that's brilliant to see. But some of the other local sides as well are getting good numbers. And again, I just wonder, is that because people are like, I've had enough of the Premier League. Yeah, it's too predictable. There's too many issues. It's too much about money, whatever it may be. I do hear other people saying that, you know, in many ways, in little ways, they're starting to fall out of love a little bit with it.
Yeah, you've opened the discussion that we're going to come back to, and we will talk football in a second. But just quickly before we do that, I presume at some point over the last couple of weeks, your mind has wandered into, what if this was to happen to Liverpool? What would I do?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, you mentioned before how we all sort of look at it from a tribal aspect, and, you know, I'd do the thing where I'd say, well, I'd like to think that we would X, so that is what I've been doing. Mm. But equally, I don't know. I don't know whether that would be the case.
What's X?
So X is, you know, oppose it. X is complain about it. X is protest about it. X is we don't want these people running our football club. X is complain to the Premier League about their joke of a test. All of those things. But I think back to when Hicks and Gillette were in situ at Liverpool, and I was one of the people that went out and protested, you know, went on the marches, even started a fanzine pretty much around protest, because I didn't feel the message was out there enough about what they were doing to our club at the time. And we were in the minority, the people who protested. There was plenty of people that just went the match regardless. When I remember giving out flyers outside Anfield and people telling me that I'd been reading too much on the internet and I should just go to the match. So there are people, I think, who support every football club who will turn a blind eye to what the football club does no matter what. Like, all they want is a winning football team, regardless of what that means. And I think a portion of fans like that exist at every single football club that's out there.
Yeah, that's definitely one we need to come back to. Existential crises notwithstanding, although maybe this is one for Liverpool. The Jurgen Klopp situation, he's back on the record saying 2024 is sort of his out time. You've got the Michael Edwards situation going on in the background. His time might come up an awful lot sooner than that. And then you have the Mo Salah situation that still isn't resolved. Do the former two, as in the Klopp and Edwards situation, mean that the owners just get Salah locked off and done because it's too important not to at this stage?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would have Mo Salah done, you know, yesterday, last week, last year, last month, whatever you want, because he's a brilliant player. He's one of the best to have played for Liverpool, in the top 10 now for goal scorers, absolute legend. And I just don't see a plan where you let him go and how that makes sense. All of the stuff I see for not signing him up doesn't make any sense at all to me. So, you know, questions about his age, well, look at his resilience, look how often he plays for Liverpool, look how many goals he scores. If anything, you know, he's currently in form, back in the sort of form he was in 2018. So, you know, it's not dipping. He's not getting worse. He's just scored a world-class goal against Manchester City. And if he wants more money, as everyone is saying he does, than the rest of the squad, if they have to break the wage structure, then do it, because who else are you getting realistically that can come in and have the impact of Mo Salah? Because Mo Salah is in Liverpool, settled in Liverpool, knows the system, his teammates know him, Liverpool play to his strengths, and that's why he scores so many goals. If you bring anyone else in, whoever that might be, even the big names who are out there, they will need time to settle, and they might not settle. And Mo is settled. And one thing that I think is a good thing about it is that he hasn't been staring himself for anything. Obviously, we've seen bits and bobs from his agents. I'm not too sure about him generally as a fella currently, but Mo Salah, you know, has not been complaining. Mo Salah has been, you know, talking about how much the fans motivate him. We've seen in his celebrations how much he's enjoying himself. He's scoring goals, and so he seems happy. But how long will he be happy while this situation's allowed to drag on? So they should get it done. Absolutely, they should get it done. And you're right to say that there are a couple of sneaking narratives out there around Liverpool, around the future, around what happens next, and they just need to get Mo done, because Mo would be a positive story. Mo would wipe away some of this residual negativity that's around Liverpool, and there shouldn't be residual negativity, by the way. I mean, Liverpool are unbeaten in the last 17 Premier League games. They're unbeaten in all comps this season in 10 games, and yet there is still this, and you're right to bring it up, there's little niggles there about, so I'm not sure about the owners and why they didn't spend in the last window. I'm not sure why they haven't tied Mo down. Why is Michael Edwards going? What are we going to do post-Klopp? There are all of those conversations, but we should all be, as Liverpool fans, much more positive than a lot of people are currently, because Liverpool are flying. Liverpool are points off top, flying in the group in Europe, through to the next round in the League Cup, all of the things that you want, scoring goals, looking good, players in form, a couple of injuries, okay, that happens. But yeah, I just think they do need to get Mo done, because it would be such a boost for everyone, and it would sort of wipe away some of those questions.
Yeah. We didn't even get a chance to talk to you about Quiven Kelleher. I set 15 minutes aside where we were going to sort of focus on.
Oh.
There'll be lots of chance for that. Gareth, brilliant stuff. Thanks, William.
Thanks a lot, fellas. Cheers.
Gareth Roberts of the Anfield Wrap there, and he just brings up so many interesting points that we're definitely going to come back to down the track about fan culture and the relationship between the owners and the fans, and plenty more besides as well. But that is it for now on Liverpool. Plenty of comments again coming in about that, but we've got to keep our foot to the mat, and we'll come back to those in a little bit. So if you do have thoughts about Liverpool, do fire them in, and we'll come back to those again. And I should remind that Liverpool fans shouldn't miss out on our next Cadbury FC roadshow. We're going behind the scenes at Anfield with legendary striker Robbie Fowler. We're also going to be joined by the Liverpool captain and Ireland international Niamh Fahey, and the former Liverpool midfielder and recently departed physio Richie Partridge. So it's all with thanks to Cadbury FC and their club partnerships, granting you behind the scenes access at Premier League's biggest clubs, coming soon to OTB Sports social channels. So stay tuned for all of that. It's coming up over the next little bit, and coming up a little bit later, we're going to talk to Alan Quinlan. We've lots of rugby to get into with him. We've a very special live crappy quiz coming your way as well. Nathan and Ger are going to join us on the line where we get stuck into it in just a little bit. Owen's been ferreting away at that, I presume that our new round system and everything is still in place, and it's lots to look forward to.
Loads. I love the way you say we've got a special crap, because of me actually getting my act together is some sort of special.
It's more of the big dogs getting out of bed. You've got that special charm to get them up and at them. Right, we're going to talk WSL and a little bit more now. I'm delighted to say football writer Flo Lloyd-Hughes is on the line. Good morning, Flo.
Morning, guys. How you doing?
Great. And thanks a million for taking the call this morning. And I was following closely the Arsenal game last night in terms of what we might chat about this morning. And the narrative building that they've started the season like a house on fire. And it certainly was a light last night.
Yeah. I mean, all in all, I don't think it was Arsenal's best performance. But I think the quality that they have is just so strong that even when they're perhaps not playing at their best, they have enough to score a lot of goals. And see them through. But I do think in European competition, especially after what happened at Barcelona last week, they do know that they need to sort of level up in playing a more complete game if they're going to compete in the Champions League this season.
Yeah, 4-0 win over Hoffenheim last night. They're top of the WSL. Obviously, new signings there, the new manager. What are you putting it down to, Flo, in terms of what this I don't want to say a full about turn in terms of their fortunes, because it's very early in the season to be making those kind of predictions. But what are you putting the upturn in form down to?
I think it's a bit of both you mentioned, really. I think the new manager has created quite a sort of aggressive attacking style. I think they take a lot more risks than they used to. They're also not adverse to playing a bit more direct. Joe Montemurro was very core in playing a possession style, maybe classically Arsenal style of football. And Younes Eidevall still has that in to some extent, but he's not afraid to play a long ball if it means going more direct and having a better opportunity to score a goal. He also wants a very intense pressing style, so he wants a lot from his players physically. And it's been interesting to see how a lot of players have managed that. It means that he needs to use his bench really well, and that's why the recruitment that they've made is even more important, because they've got a lot of depth now to bring on in the second half of games when players are looking a little bit leggy and tired. He can look to them, and it means that they're just relentless, really. So a lot of teams they've come up against have struggled to contain and compete with that.
Yeah, and they've already beaten some of the better sides, obviously. Karen Carney was talking during the week about the intensity about Arsenal this season, and the intensity in the press specifically. Is that as significant? Is there, like, because that's something you could firmly place at the door of the manager. Is there an attitude shift?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I think there's a aggressiveness, like I mentioned, to it. The press is relentless, and I think before they hadn't really played in that style where, you know, you're required to work very hard and you need to be very physical as well. And I think they've mastered that this season. They had a full preseason with him as well, which makes a massive difference. Even the players that play the Olympic Games, they came back fairly early compared to some of the other teams like Chelsea, who didn't get a lot of their Olympic players back till quite, you know, a week or so before the season started, whereas Arsenal had a core group together, bar maybe sort of Tobin Heath, who obviously came in just a couple of weeks ago. They had quite a core group together for quite a long time. So I think that really helped to get a proper pre-season under their belt, to physically get there, but also for the manager to really kind of plant his style of play on the side.
There's obviously been a huge focus on Kayleigh McCabe over here, internationals coming up over the next week as well. Are you surprised by the level that McCabe has actually hit this season? Because I think we all knew that she was amazing, but the level of consistency, staying in the team and scoring obviously three goals in as many games over the last couple of weeks, is that a level above what you expected from her this season?
I mean, not to seem like I've got some kind of crystal ball, but, you know, she was Arsenal's player of the season last season and she was unbelievable. And she was very clear, despite her brilliant numbers last season, that she wanted more. She wanted to perform even better. And so I think you could tell there was a hunger there to sort of level up things. And the versatility is ridiculous. You know, she's played at left wing back this season, but she's also played higher up the pitch as a part of a front three. So I think she's just so, so dangerous. And I think she's going to have another big, big season.
Yeah,
that versatility is really interesting, because obviously she scored a couple of screamers, and then one of the goals she scored was like a breakaway counter-attack goal as well. Like, I mean, what's her best position, I guess, is the obvious question there, but I guess it's not something that Arsenal are overly concerned with at the moment. No matter where they play her, she seems to be producing the goods.
Yeah, I imagine she probably won't play as part of the front three that much this season, just because of the players that Younes Eidevall has at his disposal. And also he's trying to balance keeping everyone happy in that respect as well. He's obviously got recruited a lot of attacking players, Tobin Heath, Aki at Paris, Iwabuchi. He's already got Beth Mead and Vivian Minamar to sort of factor into that as well. So I think we won't see her play as part of that front three in the league necessarily as much, but perhaps maybe against the smaller teams she'll get an opportunity there. But I do think in that more like comfortable left wing back role is perhaps where we're going to see her the most. And you know, she loves that role as well, and she's brilliant from a set piece, corners and free kicks. So I think, you know, she's flourishing really.
The Sky Team of the Week, she was featured in the Sky Team of the Season so far, I should say, that was named during the week. And another name that popped up that caught our interest was Louise Quinn. And I mean, it's all the more, I mean, maybe surprising might be the word I'd use, given where, you know, the position of her team at the minute. But Louise is obviously back in England, 31, has had her time in Italy and is back and is playing well enough to be included in a conversation like that. At that age, Flo, what's your sense of, you know, she's obviously getting back and getting re-established and it's very early in the season and all those caveats, but in terms of Louise's ability to maybe even get back at one of the bigger clubs?
Yeah, potentially. I think her joining Birmingham is huge for that club. She's going to be a real talisman for them this season. And any chance they have of staying up, which I think is a pretty small chance given the situation there at the moment and the investment that other clubs have put in this summer, I do think it's a small chance. But if they have any chance of survival, it's probably going to be down to Louise Quinn. She scored at the weekend when they got their first point of the season against West Ham. She's already been a huge part of the good performances that they've had this season. Yes, they only picked up their first point of the season at the weekend, but they did play quite well the previous week against Manchester United, and Louise Quinn was a massive part of that. She put her body on the line. She finished the game with a kind of big bandage on her head, doing a kind of full Terry Butcher situation. And she's that kind of player, you know? She's that kind of player, and I think that's exactly what a club in Birmingham positions need, that experience, that work rate, that desire and that leadership. And I think it'd be brilliant to see that if she continues this and has a really good season, she may be able to find a spot at a bigger WSL club.
You mentioned there a moment ago in the context of Arsenal Miedema, and Sky Sports a couple of weeks ago got a bit of traction for their Messi versus Ronaldo debate on Monday Night Football. You'd wonder if they're going to get a similar thing for putting Sam Kerr and Miedema up against one another this week, since Kerr's beginning in the WSL. How much of a debate is this at the moment, and how much are these two held up as the two best attackers in the league right now?
I haven't actually seen that much of the debate, but I think probably maybe because they're so different in what they do. I think there's always the debate about sort of Miedema being the greatest of all time, and then, you know, what other women's footballers are kind of at that level. But I think the conversation around Sam Kerr is always followed by a conversation around Fran Kirby as well, and that sort of partnership as they come as a bit of a package. So I suppose you could say, you know, what are the best partnerships? Who can compete with that Kerr and Kirby combo? And I don't really think anyone can at the moment. We haven't really seen the best of Vivian Miedema under Jonas Edelvall yet. She has been very versatile in terms of she's not afraid to drop deep and play in her teammates. But I also think she's sort of finding her feet a little bit in his system, because he wants his players to move around the pitch so much and slot into different areas and constantly be sort of aware of their teammates and provide that versatility. I'm not really sure that's quite her game, so it's sort of interesting how she fits into that. But even with her, you know, perhaps not having the best season of her career, you know, she's probably still going to cruise to at least 15 goals, perhaps probably 20 plus goals this season. So she's just that sort of player.
Manchester United, Flo, we've had plenty of contributors been on over the last couple of years that have been fairly critical of United and their general approach and backing of the team, and a bit of a sort of an odd pre-season almost as well. But for all of that, they're flying it away in the league. Is this an outlier, or is there enough? Are you seeing enough evidence in what United are doing to suggest that they can make a bit of a run of it this year?
I don't necessarily think that they could make a run of it. They might be able to secure a Champions League spot. They might be able to secure that third Champions League place if Manchester City can't work their way back up to compete with in the top three. I think it's impressive how they've managed to limit the damage from, like you said, a tumultuous summer, lots of players leaving, head coach leaving, new head coach. I think it's good to see how a lot of their new recruitments and the players that were already there have sort of bedded in together and understood the new manager's philosophy. So I think that is impressive. But I think what has shown so far already this season is the gap that still exists, because they got absolutely battered by Chelsea, made a lot of mistakes. And up until then, you know, they seemingly looked like they had quite a solid defence and had recruited well, but that kind of came undone and was unravelled all in the space of sort of half an hour. So I think although they've put on some really good performances and they look impressive, and I think they could have a good cup run and perhaps challenge for that third Champions League spot, I do think in terms of title credentials, that gap is just too big to try and breach at the moment.
Yeah. All right, we'll leave it there for the minute. Flo Lloyd-Hughes, thanks a million.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot. Keep a close track on that over the weeks and months to come. Plenty of comments coming into us, as I said, throughout the show. On the GEA, on from a bit earlier on, we've had John O'Brien saying it's either proposal B or staying with the load of muck that most people have been giving out about for the last decade, I'd say the last century, or close enough to it. Kieran Williams, GPA should strike if they're ignored. The majority want proposal B. The GEA wouldn't be long about budging then. False dichotomy and analysing the media narrative. I wonder why the media are so forthcoming for proposal B. Even the rhetoric around status quo raises eyebrows, says Michael there again.
What's the suggestion there? What's the subject? Is that a rhetorical question? If it is, by all means, answer it, because I'm not sure what that suggestion is. Like, I definitely feel that there is a great movement behind Proposal B, and I think we've been generally in favour of it because it's just a better format. By a considerable distance than the status quo. I think that's the why they like to suggest it's some sort of ulterior motive or whatever is going on. I'd just be interested in hearing that full kind of thought out.
I'd be a bit interested. I think that is exactly what you think it is, some sort of weird conspiracy thing. Anthony Ryan says, lads, you're preaching to the choir. The overwhelming majority of Gaelic football people want change, but the provinces won't allow that change, he says. So that's that on that. And then on the football, Damien saying there's a responsibility for people to know what's going on in the world, including football fans. Ignorance is not a get-out clause. And quickly followed up by somebody else saying there's absolutely not a responsibility to know what's going on in the world. Anyway, there's plenty more about that that have come in about, all sort of football, GA, the whole kit and caboodle on. Some of them we might have to edit and come back to at a later time. Needless to say, it's exercise people's opinion. And, like, at least that's the only thing that you would hope from a debate, particularly around the Proposal B versus status quo stuff, that at least people are engaged by it, they're reading and getting all the information that's needed. And that's the big question mark about why it's taken so long for the finances to have come to light. Like, were we going to find ourselves next Saturday afternoon with everybody going, like, having a debate on the floor about whether the finances made sense or not and nobody having an answer to it? It felt like it might have been, but look, at least if everybody has the full details to hand, excuse me, that's all you ask. Right, it's 8:37, it's Friday morning, you're watching RTBAM. We're going to talk to Alan Quinlan very shortly. We're going to get his thoughts on a few rugby pieces and a little bit more as well. But before all of that, a very special episode of the Football Pod with Paddy and Andy is now live. WGA star and former Ireland international rugby player Hannah Turrell joined Andy, Paddy and Tommy. She spoke about her struggles with mental health, barriers for women in sport and why she stopped playing rugby, and plenty more as well. If you've been listening to the Football Pod, it's typically strong stuff, and if you've not heard it, do yourself a favour and check it out. As ever, the best place to find all of that is the OTB Sports app, and indeed you'll find no more than the Brian O'Driscoll pieces. You will get it first if you download the app and turn on your push notifications. That'll be the first place you get 24-hour jump on everybody else if you've got the app. So that's the Football Pod with Paddy and Andy. We're going to talk to John Duggan, I think, next.
For me, it's about showing how good, you know, we can be. And it's, you know, the skill on show is not just, you know, good for a girl. I used to get that all the time when I was playing soccer as a youngster. Mm. People used to come up to me and be like, "She's pretty good for a girl." And I was like, "Why do you have to say that? Like, I'm good. I'm still good. I just, you know." And there were a few hefty challenges after those comments, you know.
But I find it with my little girl. Like, I coach the little ones in the club, you know, and I find it with my little girl Charlotte. I'd say she'd be playing against the boys, and I would still do that. You know, I would still do that. I would still go, "Oh, she was good, even though she was playing against the boys." And I was I'd catch myself. I'd just say, "Why am I saying that? You know, she was good because she's done the exact same training as the boys. Why wouldn't she be?" Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So I think it's a learned behavior. Like, I think it is a learned behavior, and it's obviously based off past stereotypes and whatever else. But, like all you have to do is look at, say, our game against Meath and on our final day and the skill that was on show and the other two games that were going on there. Like, and the game has come on leaps and bounds and it's definitely on par with the men's game. Yeah, look, we maybe can't kick it as far or whatever else, but the skill is just as good.
Yeah, that's Hannah Turley in conversation with Paddy and Andy and Tommy. And as I said, you can check it all out in the OTB Sports app. And away with you on that one. Delighted to say that John Duggan is with us now in the studio. How are you, John?
Good, Adrian and Owen, yourselves?
Good. Big news from the GAA circles last night ahead of next weekend.
Well, this was a grenade lobbed into the conversation in a nice way, 8 days out. Now, they say that there's no agenda or sides being taken in this, and I kind of do believe that in a way. I do think Larry McCarthy and Tom Ryan are, you know, very much leaving this to the counties to decide. But also, I do think there's a logistical question. Are the GAA logistically ready for this revamp if Plan B went through at Congress next Saturday? And also, culturally, is the GAA ready for this? So it might not be successful this time around, but I suppose the seed has been planted that the players want this, and there's such an exciting proposal at play. So what do we have? General Ryan telling county treasurers last night that the status quo of a backdoor system with after the provinces knockout competition and the Charlton Cup would be the most financially beneficial. So worth what, 19 point, I believe, 6 million, is it, in revenue, versus Proposal A, which I think is dead in the water, of 19.3. That's when you have the provinces that don't actually become provinces. They just these amalgamation of four groups of eight teams, and then the league championship worth 18.8 million. So I'm sure there's conjecture over those figures that's going to, you know, emanate over the next few days. And maybe we're going to have a bit of a public battle between the various vested interests around this. But ultimately, you need 60% of delegates on Saturday week to pass this, and maybe that might be a bit of an uphill struggle. Remembering that, this all has to be done by July. And the Festival of Football that I think we'd love to see would probably extend beyond that. But the split season determines now the club will get the second half of the year, and that's set in stone from what the GAA want, you know?
Yeah. Well, look, we'll see. There'll be plenty of reaction to this, I'm sure.
It's got to change, though, folks. It's got to change. It's gone through the stats here. Dublin have won 16 of the last 17 Leinsters. Kerry, 9 of the last 11 Munsters. Mayo, 7 of the last 11 Connacht Championships. Tyrone, Donegal and Monaghan have won between them 12 of the last 13 Ulsters. No Ulster title for Derry or Down, traditional counties in this millennium.
But we must keep the provinces, JD.
Fermanagh have never won an Ulster title. Antrim, as we know, Enda McGinley, they're definitely in favour of change. So, like,
is there a world in which those upsets are more likely as well under the new format, John, where you have your provincial championships as the start of the season and Dublin are coming back from their holiday after winning the All-Ireland or something? They're a little bit more vulnerable than they would be over the hard sod in the middle of the summer. That, yeah, okay, I buy the thing that, you know, it may feel like pre-season competition, but with that comes greater surprises and greater shocks for a trophy that will still matter.
I think it's probably a greater chance of a shock, in my view, Owen, when it's knockout, like you had Cavan and Tipperary last year. But I'm reading about McGrath Cups today. Like, why does the McGrath Cup, why do the O'Byrne Cup, why do the McKenna Cup, why do these competitions even exist? In my mind, I don't really understand the validity of these competitions.
Well, I presume they were sort of set up for various reasons, and they obviously do something for the coffers as well. But like, even from a playing point of view, it's, someone was mentioned earlier on about one of the games that was the Kerry under-21s. Was it the Kerry under-21s that played? Like, there is that value to it in that, like, there is that thing where managers get a short enough rein generally, and they don't want to be taking a huge amount of risks in the league even, and so it's an opportunity to have a look at a few players. And I kind of definitely get some of that. And I don't, like, you know, is Brian McAvoy suggesting that that's what happens now in the provincial championship under this new one, that becomes the tester? I don't see it, to be honest with you, because I think that the,
but if Sligo won the Connacht championship in March, that'd be a really big thing for Sligo.
Yeah.
And it'd be a separate thing from the four divisions. I still think that it's about meaning. And if Leitrim are getting hammered, what is it, 24 points by Mayo and Connacht? Most Leinster teams play one match, get beaten, and then go into the qualifiers and get beaten. A Louth or a Carlow. They get 2 meaningful games a year. You'd have 7 meaningful games. I do think, though, there should be a trophy for Division 3, Division 4 teams, rather than this knockout system. Yeah. And have your, if you want to get through to Division 1 in time, you do, like a Donegal, Jim McGuinness, whatever. But then Division 1 then should be about the All-Ireland series. So that's why I think what should happen. But I can't, the tea leaves are saying, obviously, folks, that this is probably a non-runner, you know?
I see what you're saying. At the same time, I do feel we're getting hung up about one team. Like, we're getting hung up so much about this Team 6 in Division 1. Like, I think that you don't, you shouldn't be in the you shouldn't be in the knockout phases of the All-Ireland Championship if you're getting relegated. So that's the bottom two teams. The top five are getting through to the next round. So we're talking about one team here. We're talking about that team number six. And for some people, that's holding the whole show up in terms of actually getting behind what Proposal B is as a format. So
Well, Proposal B is better than what we have at the moment, because you have, imagine, like, you got the height of good weather, you got people going to county towns. There's probably financial benefit for county towns being enlivened, Dublin going to Killarney or whatever. And if they were clever about the TV coverage and the way it's packaged and sold, as we spoke about yesterday, that you actually do have Leitrim versus Derry on TV at 2 o'clock, and then you've got the Dubs and Mayo at four. But look, it's all in the mix. But I'm a gambling man. I confidently predict by next Saturday evening we'll have the status quo of the provinces and the knockout.
I hope you lose your money, JD. I'm not going to lie. What else have we got?
Well, Raheem Sterling has been hinting that, you know, he's looking to move abroad in the future. He's got a couple of years left in his contract at Manchester City. He's only started two Premier League games so far this season, the 26-year-old. Bit of a shame whether there's a standoff with Pep or not. Now, Ferran Torres is injured for the next month, but Sterling was the best single player at the Euros, so you'd hope that he will get more game time. Such a talented player. Sligo Rovers, the latest side, tasked with delaying Shamrock Rovers' procession to the League of Ireland Premier Division title. The Hoops holding a 9-point lead ahead of their trip to the Showgrounds this evening. St. Pat's at the Brandywell to face Derry City. It's Bohemians and Dundalk at Derry Park. Waterford playing Finn Harps. Bottom club Longford Town going to Drogheda. Callum Robinson, he's had a great week, 5 goals in 2 games. He's not received a COVID-19 vaccine. He's not gone into the reasons why. We all know that. His club boss at West Brom, Valerian Ismail, has decided that he will be reminding Robinson of the benefits of the vaccine. I'm going to quote this. We will speak about it. We will have time to speak. He only came back yesterday from international duty, so it's been difficult. The first thing to say, it's a personal choice. We can't force anyone to take the vaccine. We need to respect the position of each person and not stigmatise him or make him look bad. He has the right to take his decision. The only thing I can say is I'm fully vaccinated, and the club provided earlier this week vaccination possibility for the players. The majority of our players are vaccinated now, so we've had a good feeling, but we need to respect everyone. When you're a public person, you work at a football team, you need to make sure you protect yourself, protect your teammates, protect your family, because every day we're in contact with a lot of people. At the moment, the only way we can protect ourselves is to get the vaccine. That's my own thought on this. We try to speak to the players all the time to make sure the players are aware how important this is. As we know, Callum Robinson has contracted COVID twice.
I was interested to hear, when I read the quotes from him, say that the vast majority of the playing squad are actually vaccinated. That was, I thought that was surprising, because I sort of assumed from listening to Callum Robinson that most of them weren't. But I don't know what's going to come from a chat. Like, what's he going to say to him that he hasn't already heard?
Nothing.
Exactly. So, anyway.
Rory McIlroy played a computer game around a golf last night. What, 6 birdies, a bogey, an eagle, and triple bogey on his back nine, en route to a 4 under par 68 at the CJ Cup. Shane Lowry won over Robert Streb, 11 under par in Nevada going into day two. Jonathan Caldwell won over at the Andalusia Masters. Julien Guerrier of France is 4 under par. He leads in Valderrama. Kieran Treadwell set to make his first appearance of the season for Ulster tonight in the United Rugby Championship against the Emirates Lions at Kingspan Stadium from 7:35. Mark Allen into the quarterfinals against Judd Trump at the Northern Ireland Open in Belfast. And the all-weather at Dundalk, 4:45 is the post time for the opening race, lads.
Thanks.
And tomorrow, Peter Schmeichel is on OTB Saturday.
Ah, well, look, what's he chatting about?
His life and his new book called One.
Right.
So
you had him in the studio.
I did, yeah, a couple of weeks ago, and it's going out tomorrow. We'll have a panel on the football proposals, and we'll have obviously Football Saturday with Dan and Johnny as usual, with United and Liverpool in action. So 1 o'clock on News Talk on your radio, and obviously on the OTB Sports app as well.
Good man, John. Good sell. Well done. Thank you. This week's Golf Weekly, by the way, it's as well as discussing the price of proper irons and Rory McIlroy's life balance, talk turned to a very, very divisive topic this week about how much a round of golf is really worth.
$500 for a round of golf is pushing it now. What would you pay?
But you wouldn't play the win. Beach? You wouldn't play that course.
You play it. Pebble is similar, isn't it? About 425 for Pebble.
Okay.
No, I think Pebble is 505.
Is this?
Yeah.
Adair Manor, if you're playing.
Wayne's a high roller course.
Is up in that.
You can play Bears. You can play Bears Best, which is Jack Nick. It's 18 holes of Jack Nicklaus's favorite desert course holes, all kind of a composite. course, and you can play that for like, I don't know, $80. You know, it's
see,
not.
That's what I would expect in Vegas. I would expect if I went to Vegas that they go, oh, just around this corner at the back of the Bellagio is Augusta National, perfectly recreated.
Mm. Yes. I mean,
and over there is Pebble Beach.
Yeah. I think Pebble Beach, if I was there, God, 505's painful. I think you would have to. It's that iconic, isn't it?
I didn't. Did you, Fionn?
No.
You play Pebble, have you?
Yeah.
Because we drove down and we were in Monterey and I'm going to, is it 17-mile drive or 19-mile drive? 17-mile drive. We were there and we stopped in Pebble Beach and walked around. It was the week after GMAC had won the US Open there. And there was an opportunity to play. It was up on $500. But I was like, I'm going to be going out with three really rich Americans using borrowed golf clubs. Mm. Like, is this, I don't know if I'm going to actually enjoy the full value if I were to play.
See, my logic would be, because anyone listening might be like, geez, Malloy, high roller, $500. It's actually the opposite. I'm so not a high roller. The odds of me even getting back to California a second time are slim-ish. I may never get back a second time. There are other parts of the world I'll want to see. There are only so many summers and so many holiday opportunities. My logic would be, I'm so not a high roller. I will never be back here again within touching distance. I got to do it.
I mean, when at Pebble, Owen, pay the $425, right?
You ever play Pebble? That'd be me in that course around first.
I'd love
first
to play Pebble,
terms.
Though. Yeah.
I think that's a reasonable enough price to play.
It's not as if you're going to be going out there every week. It's not PB. Like, you know. Yeah, I think it's fair enough. Like, you know, Nathan slapped myself in the head with my own golf ball, Murphy, referring to it as Pebble.
Has that story been told on it's been told on Golf Weekly behind the paywall, I guess, hasn't it?
His side, I haven't been yet asked for my opinion on it on right. I had a bird's eye view. I was actually going back to my bag to get my phone to take a video because he was in such close proximity to the wall that I thought there's a good chance of a bit of a TikTok moment here, and he rushed the shot and I didn't get my phone out in time, lamped himself in the head with the ball, fell over in a way that I thought, oof, I was going over to say, geez, that was close, was it? And then I saw like he had just very quickly, within about 30 seconds, there was a lump the size of a golf ball that developed in his head.
How does somebody smash a golf ball into a wall? Like, I mean, it's an obvious question, but you'd assume that the ball is right in front of him.
It's a very,
could
very
he have,
good
like,
question.
Could he have, taken a stroke around the wall, potentially?
So, he has just joined Newlands Cross in the last while, and Newlands Golf Club. Newlands Cross Golf will be a whole different experiment. So the big thing, and I'd been out playing with him that day, it was my first time to play the course, and the big thing he said was, listen, the thing is, everybody tells you about this course, right? There's a bit of punishment to be taken, a bit of medicine to be taken as you work your way around. There are times where you're going to go off piece a little bit, and the thing to do is just to take out your little pitching wedge and knock it 20 yards back out onto the fairway. He was literally six yards away from a 25-foot concrete wall.
Okay.
I mean,
now I'm getting it. So he went over to
do the math. You know, take a bit of a punishment. So just the other side of the ball was the green. So that was obviously in his mind. If I could just get up and over this thing. Now, having said all of that, the misfortune to have hit a concrete wall, given the sweep of opportunity of where that ball could have possibly gone after it left his club and after it left the wall, for it to come straight back and hit him right in the forehead.
Yeah, it's bad.
The probability of that is very low.
It is very low, but I guess I now know, you know, take your stroke, go backwards if you're playing Newlands.
You just got to punish it out course. And knock it around. Anyway, Golf Weekly, you can hear more about Pebble and Rory McIlroy and lots of other stuff as well. Highly recommend it. I'm a paid-up subscriber. It's $3.99 a month on your VAT on top of that, and you can head along to patreon.com, search Golf Weekly, or you can go to otbsports.com/Golf Weekly equally, and they will land you in the right direction. Are we going to Papers or are we going to Quinny? Papers, right. Irish Independent. We go to otbsports.com for you first and let you know what's happening up there. First of all, if you're looking for the details of the story that John mentioned a bit earlier on there from the finance department at the GEA and their update to treasurers of the county boards last night, it's all up there. So just head along and you can pick through the details of it. Raheem Sterling saying that he's potentially going to leave the club. And more as well besides. And we will come back to the papers in just a few minutes' time because I am delighted to say that we are now joined on the line by Alan Quinlan. Good morning to you, Quiddy.
Morning, lads. How are you?
Star of the stage and screen and the big screen and the small screen and the silver one and all besides. How's the reaction to the show been for you?
It's been very good, thanks. Yeah, it's taken a few days. I was nervous about the whole process and how it would come across and stuff, but I think it's been good. And like I said to you last week, I think the whole goal was to try and put something together that I'd get experiences and be able to interview and talk to other people and maybe put something out there that would help people and encourage them and probably from a sporting point of view, which we talk about a lot, is just dealing with that pressure in sport. And you know, Mark Smith, the clinical psychologist for Rugby Players Ireland, and I'm sure we'll talk about it again. And probably the social media scenario with sport. Mm. It's really interesting listening to John Klein was kind of rolled out from Munster this week in the media, and he was talking about the social media being off social media because of the reactionary selection in the World Cup. And so that's social media kind of story in sport. It'll just go on and on. And, it's interesting the effect it can have on people. But look, I'm really happy. I think it's something that's, there's parts of it that are very hard hitting, and then there's other parts of it from a sporting point of view that are really interesting, even still to this day to me.
We'll come back to the Jean Klein bit maybe in a minute, but one of the things that sort of jumped out for me was the, you're sort of in your head thinking, well, this is only me feeling this way, particularly around, there was the bit about the catastrophizing, Quinny, that you were talking to one of the contributors that you had on the show, like that imposter piece, you know what I mean? What he was kind of saying, well, look, actually, when you think about it, there's a load more players around the dressing room having the exact same thought. Is that something that has only recently sort of come into your thinking, that actually I wasn't really alone in this, there was a load more people thinking the same thing? Or what's been the reaction to that bit specifically?
It's definitely something that sport is different, I think, nowadays, Adrian, and people. I often meet some of my ex-teammates and we say thankfully there was no real social media presence when we were playing, because you know, like Mark Smith said in the documentary, it's very rare that you have a situation when you go to work and people can critique your work while you're doing it. Not many people experience that, and it heightens the pressure of your performance, and you kind of, you're aware and conscious of it. Their every move, every step for any high-performing athletes, individually or in a team sport, everybody comments on it. And obviously, and I think sports people say, well, I don't read the papers and I try and stay away from it, and probably getting a balance in that, but you hear things and you hear comments, and particularly for GA players, I think, you know, they're amateur guys who've given a hell of a lot of commitment and sacrifice, and even in club games throughout the country, you know, in rural parts of Ireland, you know, Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, in local communities, people talk about that. So, looking around the dressing room, yeah, I always thought, and everybody was different because different guys had different routines before matches, and that made them calm and relaxed. I had a kind of a ritual before any match. When we got to the stadium, I would always leave down my bag, get my seat, organize my gear a little bit, and then head out onto the pitch, and I would do kind of half a lap of the pitch, and then end up trying to do some visualization to make me calm under the post. And that was just something I did for every game, no matter where it was. And that gave me a little bit of calmness and stopped most of that catastrophizing. But, you know, I suppose if you're losing control of that and you're in a tough place, because sport, so many ups and downs, isn't there? Mm. And if you're on a losing run and you start to hear and feel the negativity that's out there, it can really hamper your performance. So, it's something that, you know, is heightened in modern day sport, and you know, it's about getting help and support for that. And you know, most teams, even amateur sports, have access to, you know, psychologists and sports psychologists to try and keep their confidence and self belief high. So that's a continuing situation, even at the very, very top of professional sport.
Yeah, and have you, you've mentioned about speaking to some of your former teammates, like that element of the catastrophizing, you know, on all sorts of scales, and you know, that sort of lack of assurance or that imposter syndrome. I think the more you talk to people in any industry, including this one, that you find that people are somewhere on that scale at some point in their week, most weeks. Have you found that's been a conversation you've been able to have with former teammates that you might have thought, geez, that fellow was so sure of himself and so confident, so cocky, and actually, in reality, wasn't really the case?
But even for me, when I speak about this, Adrian, it's not something that I would have had all the time. You know, if you're in a good place and your team are doing well and you're winning and you feel secure in any sort of environment, even away from sports, you have a calmness. But if self-doubt creeps in, or you're coming back from an injury, or you're carrying a knock, or there's some sort of performance pressure there, that's when that negative voice can come in and start playing havoc with you. But it's about the balance. You know, I remember so well, I forget a lot, lots of parts of my career, but I remember before the 2008 final, you know, being in a good place. Because 06, I had the injury and I came on at the end, and I was the happiest substitute ever to be part of a match day squad. Finally won it, got on the field for a few minutes, didn't touch the ball, didn't make a tackle, didn't hit a ruck, ran around for 4 minutes thinking, blow the whistle, I don't care. I've nothing to, I don't care if I don't do it, saying, you know, the way substitutes come on the field, you want to get stuck in, you want to get the ball, you want to do so. I didn't care. I just wanted that whistle. And that was a culmination of, you know, 9 or 10 years of being part of the group and finally just being there. 08 was different. I was fit. I was strong. It was on the back of the World Cup season where, you know, I had that frustration not playing at the World Cup. Turned it into a positive and trained really hard and came home really fit, started playing really well for Munster. And obviously we get to a final and I'm in a good place, but I sat in the dressing room in the Vale at Lamar, or in the room with Rog. We roomed together. And I just remember that the nerves, they were good nerves, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They were like anticipation. We knew we were playing a great Toulouse side, but it was really good nerves. So it's important to remember, and I don't want to put this across, that, you know, I went out every time and I'm in a ball of negativity. I'm not. It's just controlling that. And sometimes it's on the back of a bad performance or making mistakes or catastrophizing the possibility of it going wrong. Being in the room that night, I remember a calmness around the nerves. We were both very nervous, but we were really looking forward to it. So there's a balance, and sometimes people need help with that balance to use those nerves in a positive way to really stimulate you.
How much was that down to you sharing a room with Ronan on the night? Like, was there certain members of the team that had a more calming influence?
Yeah, there always is, you know what I mean? It wasn't solely down to it. I think it was down to probably just being having a good run that season myself, Adrian, and Owen, and being happy with my fitness. And so for any sports person, if you can tick most of the boxes around your strength, fitness, your conditioning and all that stuff, and you're in a good place and you're in the back of some good performances and you're in a team with strong, resilient people, that helps. It doesn't matter if you're who you're rooming with. But, you know, obviously when you're with someone, like I would have always looked, Rog would have been one of the people I would have looked at that, he was very he was very kind of hyper energetic throughout the week, but he was really calm as well. And he had that strong natural resilience. So of course the likes of him would help. You know, I always say this about, and I've been asked about it this week about Axel, and his anniversary is on Saturday. It's unbelievable. I think it's 5 years. He was someone who oozed in that kind of calmness, and people that feeds out to people, you know, around them, because it's about the challenge or the situation you're about to face. And when you have someone who's a lot of experience and has a really calm temperament who goes, well, it'll be fine, it'll be grand. And that's the way Axel always kind of was. You know, I played with him in a Shannon team when I was under 20s and right through to a very successful Shannon team that won 4 All-Ireland leagues in the late 90s. And we were a very successful club side. But and I was young and probably full of the wildness and energy that you like to have, but not being able to control that and being overzealous in my performances and just playing with him. I used to say to him before games, just if I get a bit hyper here and I'm shouting at the referee or my teammates or the opposition, just calm me down. And sometimes I would just look at Axel or he would just look at me and say, it's grand, Quinny, calm down, relax. And it was that little trigger that just took away that catastrophization that was going on or that just lack of control. And so some players, obviously, Paul was brilliant. Guys who become captains, Jim Williams, Mick Galway, you know, Keith Wood, these guys, they help people who are, and everybody is different. And going back to what Adrian asked at the start, you're in a dressing room with so many different characters and most of us are trying to put on a front that everything is calm and everything is controlled. And usually when you go out onto the fields, we're all fine because we can do it there. But it's sometimes the build-up that kind of exhausts you, you know. So there's always an intrigue about getting the emotion right, getting the tempo right in any sport and using it in a positive way.
When you spoke about Anthony there, you had a smile came across your face. A lot of fond memories. Alan, I wonder, do you, 5 years on, it seems incredible in some ways that from the outside looking in, it seems to have gone. It seems like yesterday that those events were unfolding in some ways. Do you think about them a bit more this week or, yeah, where are your thoughts at?
Of course you do because, you know, his name has been mentioned. It's out there that Munster are going to honour him. It's just strange at times to think that because I had so many experiences with Axel in my life and he was an integral part of my rugby career, he was just always there. That it's just hard to believe that the time has kind of gone so quickly. And so, you know, you try and think of the good times. And I was asked a couple of times from various different people this week about happy memories, and they kind of jump to mind, loads of those. So you try and remember him in a really good way, in a positive way. His son scored a try for Munchins during the week. They're little moments that you kind of think, I think how proud Axel himself would have been and how happy he would have been. His nephew scored as well, played for Munchins. And so it's those kind of moments that you think about. And it's just hard to believe that the time has gone so quickly. And you think about that week and what happened to him and the whole situation. And look, I always have the regret and it always comes back to me. And this is maybe my catastrophizing of criticizing Munster when Anthony was there on Sky a long number of years ago. That kind of regret of actually, you know, being in a situation where I'm criticizing a team that one of my closest friends and someone I soldiered with for so long is the coach. So that's part of the catastrophizing that's still going on. But
he would have known, Quinny, I presume. I don't know if you ever had a chance to talk to him about it, but it was coming from a place like the one thing that anybody who listens to this show with any regularity or anything that you have to say is that the place that Munster did and still does obviously hold for you. That's the source, obviously, of that, where that criticism is coming from.
Yeah, it was. And look, I haven't spoken about this, but I got in touch with Anthony after that pretty much straight away. And he responded to me with, you know, a very polite kind of response. It wasn't a case of he was fuming with me. He understood where I was coming from, and we ended up speaking about it a lot. We went away at the end of that season we had a reunion in Portugal with the 06 team, yeah. And we had a few drinks together. But look, you know, it's something that I wish just didn't happen. It was like you and me, Adrian, having a chat about a team's performance, and it just came out, frustration, anger out of me. But look, it is what it is, and it probably was coming from a place of just frustration and not wanting Munster to do well. And I still to this day want him to do well. And I knew he'd given his whole life to Shannon, to Munster, to Ireland. And, you know, there's a part of me just wish, God, I could have, I wish they were winning and I didn't have to you know, critique him in any way, but it was coming from a place of not the team or not anyone's performance. It was just, I thought things should have been better and needed to be better, and the structures needed to be better, and he needed more support. I think there was part of me, and I still to this day think he needed more resources. He needed more quality, maybe in the overseas signings and stuff like that. And he was copping a lot of flack and pressure. And the big disappointment was I added to that, you know. And but it was in a strange way, I was trying to vent my frustration that he needed more and Munster needed to invest more in this. And but you know, look, when you come off a team that's winning and having success and on a good run, maybe I expected that this should be happening all the time, and maybe I was wrong for that. And that expectation is still there with the players today, and they've got to carry that. Sometimes it's a little bit unfair.
You say there, Alan, that you carry some of that guilt today. Like, you were in a very unique position there, as in a pundit of prominence who also was very close to the coach of the team. Like, is there anybody over the course of the last few years that you can talk to try and, I'm not sure if resolve is the right word, but try and help that level of guilt, anybody who is in a similar position to you? Because there would only be a handful of people who would understand both sides of that game.
It's not even a guilt is probably too much. It's just it's probably just a level of frustration. Because, you know, when you go back so far with someone, I started under 20s with Anthony. We knew each other so well. He was always so helpful when we played, and I kind of looked up to him. You know, I was really close to Olive. I was there right at the start when Anthony and Olive, his wife, started going out together. So I was there from the start with him, and you know, we had a good bond and stuff like that. So it was just more. I wish it didn't happen,
yeah.
But and it was coming from a place that seemed like very, very negative, but it was a frustration. So yeah, I've spoken to ex-players and had that discussion, and they've all tried to reassure me that. And you know what? That's the measure of Axel. Like I said, I haven't really spoken about that, but he reassured me that it was grand and don't worry about it and just be careful. Sometimes you can get kind of drawn in by ye guys in the media, you know, that type of one. by Adrian Barry, the likes of Adrian
You're
Barry.
You're one of us now, Quinny. Don't ever get
controversial stuff out of me. But no, he was... We had a laugh about it. And look, it was harder on the players as well, because look, a lot of the players that time were learning, and they were learning the hard way, and they were in an environment that was tough, that expectation and pressure was there. So I always say this to people, and maybe I've, you know, doing anything here, and you'd probably agree, when you're talking about performances, whether it be with Ireland or Munster or anyone else or any of the other provinces, when they win, it's an easy post-match scenario. Or if you're on commentary, it's enjoyable and it's easier. But sometimes you have to kind of be honest and try and be honest. And I certainly didn't mean it personally to anyone.
No,
but
look at it.
For the listeners, it's not something that I'm, you know... I just wish it was a bit different, you know.
Yeah.
We all have little regrets like that. So
of course. And look at it. And he would have known that too.
Everything to heart in my life, and it is personal. I'm not catastrophizing about everything. I'm much more in a controlled place. My sport was wonderful. I enjoyed 99.9% of it. Is there things I'd like to have changed? Yes, like over any other athlete.
Yeah.
I look back and think maybe, you know, if I could control it at better times, I might have put it in a more energetic way, you know. So because, yeah, like I said, nerves are good, and they can be bad and stop people as well. And that's the intrigue of sport, which will always be there. On the day, we hear this comment, who wants it more? Who's more in control? Desire, emotion, passion, all those things. And there's a great intrigue about being part of a team, whether you're a coach or a player. And that's why people are in sport. So the rewards are fantastic as well.
Yeah, and Anthony's passing as well. We should note will be marked at the Connacht game, obviously tomorrow as well, which falls 5 years on. Quinny, we'd loads of other stuff to talk to you about, but that was definitely more interesting route to go down. So thanks for bringing us down there. Enjoy the rugby over the weekend, and we will catch up with you on Monday.
Cheers, lads. Thanks.
Thanks, Million. Alan Quinlan on the line there. And a reminder as well that Breakdown, Ireland's mental health battle, is available on the Virgin Media Player. It's well worth your time. You head along there and check it out. And also, you can hear much more of Quinny on Munster. It's our brand new Munster Rugby podcast. Alan Quinlan and Niamh Briggs is now live every Wednesday. They're going to bring you in-depth analysis of each weekend's games, interviews with some of the biggest players, and all the action from other teams around the province as well. The first episode is live. It's available every week, wherever it is you get your podcasts. The full video available too on the Rugby Channel YouTube page, and you can find them on Twitter too. It's at Rugby Channel 15, and the very first episode of the Red 78 is live, so you can head along to the OTB Sports app and indeed beyond to pick up the latest episode there. OTB Sports Radio today from 1 o'clock, OTB Gold. It's going to be Manuel Petit, the subject of that interview there. Friday Night Racing with Ger and
Colin Keane.
Colin Keane in the hot seat today, and Johnny Ward as well. That's from 4 o'clock, Team 33 League of Ireland legend as Tony Sheridan. The life and times of Ackle legend, the greatest Ackle man of all time, they say, Johnny Kilbane, will be OTB Gold from 6, and then Off the Ball live in the radio from 7 o'clock this evening. Right up next on OTBM, the crappy quiz is back. Chris Bond.
Oh, you're kidding me.
September.
Kyle Lafferty.
Are you joking me?
Is that right?
I know!
Is that right?
Anybody else?
Leash, was it?
Like, that is one of the most stupid questions.
Darius Vassell? Seriously, you all need to just stay quiet. This is getting really annoying doing this quiz.
What is going on here?
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome along to the shoutiest segment on Irish radio. It's the scintillating, it's the stupefying, it's the splendido crappy quiz. Every Friday, we pit three of Team Off the Ball up against one another in a no-holds-barred quiz of sporting factoids at the end of the week. Allow me to welcome today's contestants. Our first contestant today is still enraged by Jake White's comments about Connacht last week and those who can't make it at the top level moving from east to west. But As this contestant knows, people can move from west to east too. After all, he did move from the west side of Athlone to the east side of Athlone and hasn't looked back since. It's Leinster's favourite Connacht person, Adrian. Who's your daddy, Barry?
I thought you were that was a Nathan introduction here. I couldn't give it. How are you getting on about what Jake White had to say? What did you say? I moved from the west side to the east side.
I mean, you can't look at the other way around. Dissecting the jokes and ruining them.
That wasn't really a joke, to be honest with you.
I don't know what it was, George, comedy death.
You probably hit the nail on the head there. I'm really not sure. There was certainly nothing based on any fact in there.
But you're from the Connacht side of Athlone.
Incorrect.
Okay, move on.
He's from Mullingar.
Are you from Mullingar?
We all know that. He pretends to be from Athlone.
Why would you be calling me the Athlone Bone if I'm from Mullingar?
I forgot about that. First stage of being from Mullingar is acceptance, Adrian, I think.
No, I'm from the Westmead side of Athlone, and very clearly so. End of.
Our next contestant today is lording it over everyone after a wildly successful few weeks. He finally feels now that he has got redemption for every single negative moment in his life. That's right. This man is 60 points clear of his children in his family fantasy football league. Can you guess which kids are going to lose all of their communion money next May? Give it up for the Beast of Ballyhaunis, Nathan Nate Dog Murphy.
It's true. It's very true. They keep making stupid mistakes. They won't listen to me, but it means that I do every...
You just called your kid stupid on the radio.
Every Sunday. You know, I've got those bragging rights, which is all that matters.
That's why Nathan's doing all those mixers. It's so that he can pay for the very expensive therapy bills that his kids are going to have for when they eventually come to adulthood. And they're like, yeah, my dad used to go on the radio and give out about my fantasy football skills.
What mixers?
Are there mixers?
This is news to me.
Our last contestant today is back after a borderline nihilistic act of self-sabotage in Nace last weekend. His tyre survived the darkest moments in what was the perfect preparation for Ultimate Hell Week 2022. Give it up for the artist formerly known as the Mustachioed Menace, Ger Gilroy.
Coming back, it's nearly October.
It is nearly November, indeed. We bringing it back?
Oh yeah.
Nice. You're welcome. You're welcome to the studio. It's good to have you back. It is Ger versus Nathan versus Adrian. Kenny Cunningham has been ruthlessly ditched this week from the lineup. As ever, the format is a classic crappy quiz with a series of questions on a range of themes. Then it's on to the slip and slide of trivia, which is the rapid fire round. You can podcast a crappy quiz on otbsports.com or on the OTB Sports app. And if you're watching on YouTube, make sure to click the thumbs up, even if we contribute nothing but misery to your morning. Please send any questions you have via postcard to Crappy Quiz Quizmaster, Off the Ball Towers, Marconi House, Diggs Lane, Dublin 2. Round 1 is the boring questions round. Never multiple choice. Question 1 is for you, Adrian. Name the two Irish head coaches of URC teams.
Oh.
Wow.
Rugby man.
What was the question? Sorry, I was reading the paper.
There are two Irish head coaches in the URC.
Head coach specifically.
Reading the paper is cheating.
Well, I'm reading the paper about the option B and the, like, I'm trying to
question.
Keep up with modern times, Nathan.
The head coach is your specific question, is it?
Yes.
This is becoming boring now. Answer it. Bing, 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 ding.
No, come on,
sound effects. Thank you.
No.
Yeah,
no,
time is up.
It's not. It's come on, Adrian. Give me one at least.
What? How long is he gonna get?
The buzzer's already gone.
Come on.
It's okay. Time's up, Adrian. You've completely blanked. Anyone?
Leo Cullen.
Leo Cullen is one.
No, but he's not the head coach. That's why I asked you that question.
He is. Yeah. Yeah.
Ah, for Jesus Christ! That's literally why I. Is he? Really?
Yeah, he is.
Is he not director of rugby?
No,
he's his head coach. And the other one. Michael Bradley of Zebre.
It was pretty obvious.
I should have got the first. Well, you didn't know either of them when he threw it out to the floor.
Well, I'm too busy reading the papers.
Nathan, who is the top scorer overall across all groups in the European section of qualifying for the 2022 World Cup?
Go on, give us the cycle.
Well, my shortlist, Adrian, is...
Heyo. Always a good judge of a shortlist.
Nathan's at the sharp end this morning. He's not.
Come on.
Ronaldo.
No, it's not Ronaldo.
Really,
no, it's Memphis Depay with 9 goals.
Wow. Memphis.
Sure. Newcastle United are almost certainly going to break their transfer record fee in the next transfer window. Mm. Can you name any of the players that currently occupy their 3 most expensive players of all time?
Alisson Maximum.
No. Too quick.
Alan Shearer.
Joe Linton.
Joe Linton is number 1, Nathan, correct. Number 2 is Joe Willock. And number 3?
Andy Carroll.
Jeff Hendrick.
Michael Owen.
Oh. Wow, how much did they spend for Michael Owen?
30 million maybe, something
what?
Like that.
No.
Yeah, I think so.
No.
I think so. Joe Linton is like 25 million.
More than I think so.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I still think Adrian has a case about director of rugby, but sure, look
at that up here.
He lost that point. He's looking it up. He's looking it up. He's on the internet.
I'm looking up Leo.
You're on
he's
the
on
internet. The internet.
Round
he's
2. Let's internet. Go.
Come on. Record, close down. Record
transfers. Mike Lone, sorry, is £22.5 million, but, you know, close enough to €30 million. Joe Linton was £39 million, and Joe Willock was £26 million. We move on to round 2.
They're all very different numbers, but anyway. Make him close his laptop.
I have to accept. I have to accept when I'm in the wrong. It's Leo Cullen, head coach.
He needs to close his laptop.
No, you I need to be in communication
come on.
With the producer.
No, you don't. He can shout in your ear. Come on.
Quizmaster, sort it out.
You're experienced enough now. You can talk in your ear and you can talk at the same time.
Round 2.
Pat your belly and rub your head. Look at this. He's got it open.
Yes, come on.
Put him down on the ground.
Round 2 is the International Men of Mystery round. To mark the end of another glorious international break, I'm going to give you the name of a country, and all you've got to do is name any player who has ever played in the Premier League from that country. Adrian, Estonia.
Oh, for crying out loud.
So you want somebody from this country who's played in the Premier League? So
yes.
Distracted by the newspaper again.
Yes.
Right.
Are there Estonian footballers on the front page of the Irish Times sports section this morning?
This is absolutely ridiculous. Estonia.
Estonia.
Sammy Hoopia's brother. I have no idea.
In fairness, you can get a ferry from Estonia to Finland.
Can we just
Mart Plum?
Pause for a moment. Yep. Sammy Hoopia's brother was his answer.
Like, I haven't a clue.
Who? So. What's the name of the Estonian footballer? Adrian Barry on the record said Sammy Hoopia's brother.
You were giving out earlier on about explaining the gag. That was the gag. I don't know the answer.
Okay.
Nathan, there's been one other than Mart
Plum. Definitely a gag. It was definitely
Marian Pahars.
No, he's Latvian.
Oh, that next question.
Liverpool player.
switch that out.
Marian Pahars.
Ragnar Klavan was the other Estonian player.
That was tough now. I hope the rest of them are as tough.
Nathan, the country for you is Kenya.
Premier League commentator. All around Billy Big Balls when it comes to football. Bit of a quiz geek.
That's a good question. Good question.
Kenya.
People are screaming at the radios right now.
We haven't yet.
Kenya, well, yeah. It's a country in Africa, of course, famous for its coffee.
I'm thinking Southampton.
And the runners.
Yeah, the runners.
Maasai tribe.
I'm thinking Southampton.
Brother Colin.
Good safari. Of course, that story this week could easily venture into Partridge territory here.
Nathan, I'm going to need to push you for an answer.
Come on, Nathan, say something, anything.
Please.
Mario Lemina.
No, you were a long...
I was going to say Mario Pahars there.
I think if we'd left you another 5 minutes, you would have got there. The answer is Victor Wanyama.
I knew it was a Southampton midfielder.
Wow.
The only Kenyan who's ever played in the Premier League.
It's a bad moment for Nathan.
Jared, you should get this. Honduras.
I think he's challenging the "you should get this" theory.
Can you name a Honduran Premier League footballer?
Or just any Honduran footballer? Is that not the actual challenge here? It's just saying a name of somebody from that country.
I can't.
whose brother are you opting for?
Is it a right winger? Am I in the right area of the pitch?
Honduras and a right winger, probably.
In terms of taking a stab at a rough area.
I thought it was goalkeeper centre back for Estonia.
This is Murphy levels.
Come on, let's go.
Distraction.
Give us a guess.
It's a striker. It's one of those strikers who would score in patches.
No, what are you thinking of, Rodiega or someone like that? I don't know. No, that's not the answer. You got Wilson Palacios. Yeah. Maynor Figueroa. It was the other one. Then you've also got Roger Espinosa, Ivan Guerrero, Milton Nunez, and Hendry Thomas. But Palacios and Figueroa, probably the two most famous. So we are two rounds in. It is 0-0 as we move on to round three, which is the sports book on or near the Quizmaster's desk round. Bringing back a classic.
Where's the round from last week that everyone thought was a massive success? The first time anyone's ever complimented your quiz.
What was it?
And you decided to get rid of Nathan. Nathan did really well with it, Jared.
This is the short story.
I only listen to the opinions that are most acutely put to me, and the acute opinion on the show last week was that it was a disaster of a round, that it was this weird experimental stuff that you guys didn't get.
It definitely was weird.
We put it on ice for a little while.
We got a couple of the answers right now. He's like, he's all in, even though he doesn't still fully understand the rules.
We're bringing back a classic crappy quiz round this week. This round will test your knowledge on a sports book that happens to be near my desk in the office. This week, the book is The Last Line, My Autobiography by, of course...
I have no idea.
Baker.
It's Packy Bonner's book. I mean, guys, come on. The Last Line. So,
how is Packy Bonner's book on your desk? It must have come out in like 1993 or 97.
2015.
Oh, really? A new book?
Yeah, yeah.
Who wrote it?
The Last Line.
I don't know. The Last Line, yeah.
Not finished yet, though, Packy. Packy's one of the most influential and important voices in our football at the moment.
He would argue that he's one of the last lines of defence.
Him and Waterford Crystal, they have the same name in their autobiography.
Can you libel a horse?
Adrian, question three for you. It wouldn't be Packy Bonner's autobiography without talking about Italia 90 and his mad face.
that he used to scare his Dutch opponents in Palermo. Bonner says in the book that he wasn't even trying to scare his Dutch opponents. Rather, he was angry at one of his teammates for repeatedly looking for the short ball. Which teammate was this? Was it A, Mick McCarthy, B, Steve Staunton, or C, Kevin Moran?
Well, the short ball back then was probably still 50 yards away. He was looking up the pitch when he did it. He wasn't looking across the defence. So I've got to go for Kevin Moran.
No, it was Mick McCarthy.
What?
Mick McCarthy apparently came up to him repeatedly during the game looking for the short ball. He's like, go.
The only thing about that is that obviously you could just give it straight back to him. So you could get the ball off the goalkeeper and give it straight back to him.
Which he would have done.
That's
in the
1990,
yeah.
Right, well, Mick McCarthy is the answer there. We've still yet to score a point here, guys. Nathan, in Bonner's book, we are regaled with tales from the 2002 World Cup and, of course, Saipan, which includes him saying that his own bust-up with Roy Keane went viral. He also tells this story, and I wanted you to fill in the blank here now. I've forgotten to bring the book in with me, so I can't actually read the thing. But I've got him telling the story on a different platform.
I don't even understand this.
So fill in the blank here.
Oh,
fill in the blank here. It's the same story. He told it somewhere else. So, fill in the blank. I've got to blame blank for Roy, says Bonner, complete with a wry smile. I'm going to blame everything on blank, because when we were heading out to Saipan, we were in Amsterdam airport. You remember that skit on Today FM, Roy Radio, and blank had it on his laptop. I remember him playing it and all the boys gathering around and having real fun listening to Roy's voice. Roy was sitting up about 20 yards away reading his book, and you could see the steam coming out of his ears. Who is the blank in this case?
I mean, it's obviously really...
It's multiple choice. A...
Oh, no! Multiple choice, no!
It's almost as if, like, I didn't write this. A, Niall Quinn. B, Ian Hart. Or C, Shay Given.
Well, in my head was Shay Given, so I'm going to go with Shay Given.
You would have wanted to have got that right, because I think I'm reading it from otbsports.com, and he's telling this at a roadshow, and I'm pretty sure you represented the roadshow.
No, I didn't.
So you didn't do that one. Okay, fair enough.
Kev did that, did he?
It was 2020.
It wasn't Shay Given telling the story. It was
Packy Bonner telling the story. Yeah,
it was Packy Bonner and Shay Given together.
Right. Question three for you, Ger.
That was a bit of a fix. He would have organised both those guests,
exactly,
knowing that they were together and knowing that this was one of those stories.
He would
he was
have poured
tell.
Over those interviews about 14 times before they went to air. Ridiculous.
In his book, Ger, Packy Bonner reveals his opinion that the Thierry Henry handball was karma for a previous bit of fortune that had gone in Ireland's favour. Was it karma for A, Roy Keane getting sent home from Saipan, which was actually a massive boon for the team? B, the referee not awarding a penalty against Shay Given when he took Ruud van Nistelrooy down in the 2001 Lansdowne Road game? Or C, the referee not spotting Bonner off his line for every single Romanian penalty at Italia 90? Which of those three things was an evil committed by Ireland that was karma?
If it's A, then we're going to have words, Packy. is it what? So his wry smile is obviously the giveaway from the previous one. Is it karma for him being off his line for every penalty, or Shay? It's his book. Makes more sense for him to be telling the story against himself, as opposed to for Shay, because then, although it's the same group.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I hear you, Nathan.
this.
I gotta go for.
This is what it sounds like listening to you answer a question.
For him being off his line.
No, that's not correct. Shay Given. He feels that was when he saw the Henry handball, he was like, "That's karma."
Well, at least Ger got a 50-50 question anyway, Nathan. You know, we had three options to deal with. Ger got a 50-50 straight up. Phone a friend. I mean, the first one was a joke answer.
The scores are Nathan 1, Adrian 0, Ger 0. Round 4 is the fun-free magic number round.
It was a good round last week. I don't know what was so good about it.
Oh. It was so good, Ger. You should have been there.
It's grim.
Contestants.
I'm serious. Afterwards, literally everybody was like, great round, great addition, got to be in every week.
Yeah, but at the time, you were like, oh, Owen's gone all experimental again. This was my Kid A moment, and you just didn't appreciate it.
No, and Kid A, afterwards, everyone went, wow, actually better than their other stuff.
I agree. And you just didn't appreciate it at the time, but look, we move on. Contestants get 3 points for getting the number exactly right in round 4. If no one manages that, the nearest contestant who doesn't go bust gets 2 points. The second closest gets 1 point. I'm going to state that we can only accept the answer that's written on your paper. I'm also going to have to ask for your pens once the music ends. So, if you don't mind, give us the following number.
the number of goals Katie McCabe has scored in the Women's Super League so far this season, plus the number of players Stephen Kenny has handed senior international debuts to as Republic of Ireland manager, plus the number of tries Munster have scored in their three URC games so far this season, plus the number of senior international caps won by Chidoze Ogbeni. Your 30 seconds expire when Sinatra sings Bright Shiny Beads.
What's the second one?
The second one is the number of players Stephen Kenny has handed senior international debuts to as Republic of Ireland manager. The first one is the number of goals Katie McCabe has scored in the Women's Super League so far this season. Then you've got the number of tries Munster have scored so far in the United Rugby Championship. And then how many caps does Chidoze Ogbeni have so far? Add them all up. So what do you guess?
I couldn't have read my own writing there for a minute.
Nathan, what have you got?
33.
Adrian?
23.
The answer is 34. So Nathan gets a two, Jura gets one. Nathan, once again, nailing the rapid fire round, or the numbers round, I should say. Let's go through these. So the number of goals McCabe has scored in the WSL?
Three.
The number of players Kenny has handed international debuts to?
9.
11.
13.
11. Bazunu, Kelleher, Omar Bamadeli, Nathan Collins, McGrath, Knight, Malumbi,
and two
Ida,
from two so far.
Benet, Darrow O'Shea, and Manning. The number of tries Munster have scored so far in the league is 17.
Oh, jeez.
And Chidoze Ogbeni has three senior international caps.
I had three of the four answers spot on.
That's so unlucky, man.
Well done.
What do I get? Some sort of runner-up prize.
Yeah, there's like a
couple of extra points.
Just the tree behind Nathan. You can catch him.
Participation trophy.
We move on to the final.
So what's the score?
3-1-0.
Doing me fix this so that he doesn't get to just go first and that's the end of it.
Well, we'll see.
That's like the shittest competition of all time.
Well, it's like been the shitty competition for about 5 years now. So
yeah, and it's crap. We've realised. You know, like, we've taken the evidence. Mm-hmm. We've seen that it's bad and that it doesn't lead to competition. And we're continuing. Mm-hmm. We're continuing with the old ways.
The status quo.
You're not allowing Ger for the fact that the first two questions are loaded.
I mean, how can you give anybody any grief when you can't get your own house in order, Sheehan? You're a hypocrite.
Well,
the first two questions are loaded, though.
What do you mean they're loaded?
Let's not forget.
The hardest question's going, right?
Failure.
Ah, I mean,
that used to be a thing.
I want competitive balance, Nathan. That's all. It's not rewarding failure.
What you want
failure.
Is to be we able are, to underperform and underperform and underperform, yet still get one final get-out clause.
We are up against it, so we move on to the final. Our winner tonight will be decided in the round that separates the men from the boys, the Jeff Hendricks from the Jeff Bezoses. It's a no theme in particular, ridiculously easy rapid-fire round. The score you get in this round will be added to your score in the previous round. There will be 40 seconds for everyone to answer from the same set of questions. You've got to pluralise it, Nathan. We've got to start with the person with the highest number of points. That's Nathan.
Then
on to the person in second, and then onto the person in last, which is Adrian. If you get a question correct, I'll ask you a question and keep asking you questions. It's Bezai, actually, is the plural, until you get one wrong. And then once you get a question wrong, I move on to the next person, and you get deducted a point. Nathan Murphy, are you ready?
Always.
Your 40 seconds starts now. What U.S. state is Deontay Wilder from?
Pass.
Too long.
New Jersey.
Alabama. Next up is Jer. Georgie Kelly plays for which League of Ireland club?
Bohemians.
Correct. Name the Kansas City head coach.
Andy Reid.
Correct. Who won the Masters this year?
Bryson.
No, Matsuyama. Leanne Kiernan plays for what club, Adrian?
Liverpool.
Correct. Who's top of the Premier League?
Chelsea.
Correct. Does Niall Morgan play club football for Eden Dork or Errol Kieran?
Dork.
Correct. Which championship team plays at Bloomfield Road?
Birmingham City.
No, Blackpool. Who were Nations League champions before France, Nathan?
Portugal.
Correct. Who is the new Cork football manager?
Rickon. Keith Rickon.
No, he's wrong. He's wrong.
Keith Rickon. So,
Keith Rickon. Yes.
You said Deith Rickon.
Keith Rickon.
He's like a Game of Thrones character.
I heard Ricketts.
Said Keith Rickon.
I heard Ricketts.
Either way, you're safe, Nathan. I don't think you're going to be caught there because, Ger, you ended up gaining 1 point, which brings you to two. Nathan would stay at three, given what he had currently done there. And got plus two as a result of what he did, which brings him up to two. So you did well, guys. If you'd got Bloomfield Road as Blackpool, you would have caught Nathan. But Nathan, congratulations. Let's play the music.
Champ, 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 champ. Play my music.
fake.
The game is fake.
What do you have to say for yourself?
Everybody knows the dice are loaded.
Well, my daughter looks delighted here. She's like, I'm only 10 minutes late for school because you did this bloody quiz. So I should probably go and bring her.
He is going to be rubbing it into your face if your fantasy football team does badly this weekend, is the warning. Nathan, congratulations. Thank you, Ger. Thank you, Adrian, for taking part. OTBAM has been brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors.
OTB AM. With Gillette, put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.